everyone. With regard to my television shows, I do have a catalog back there of the shows that I have done over the last 5 years, and many of them are people who have appeared on Art Bell's show and are familiar names to you, David Oates, and Richard. I have done a short segment with him when he was here in Seattle before, but there is a whole list of people, and so you're free to take a copy of that. So to all of my new people who came today, welcome. And we're going to have a fantastic day today, as we did yesterday. It was just awesome information. You won't be disappointed. Today, we will continue to examine the connection between Mars and free energy and about the coming changes in our lives that are quite dramatic. I think you'll be amazed if you did not hear yesterday's. We're wondering, how does Cydonia and Egypt and hyperdimensional physics and its geometry relate to an intelligent civilization such as we are, who have tools, such as our hands, to create methodologies for us to live by? How are we all connected? Is all of this part of this whole thing? And maybe there's other ancient civilizations about which we don't know. And how does all this knowledge make a difference in our lives? Could this of our own technological society be on the brink of extinction or interstellar travel? You're about to experience an unprecedented event. Having these three men together for the very first time is an awesome experience, and you are so blessed to be here, and I honor you for that. Some of you will experience the technical information, and what I know for myself is I just ride with it, and it's the repetition over and over, and pretty soon the pieces of the puzzle begin to fit together, and then you have a whole picture. So try not to get too hooked in and stuck on some of the technical terms, because just keep moving with it. Those of us who are non-technical sometimes stop and we try to figure it out, but just flow with it and let your subconscious mind do the work for you. So just stay with us, and we're going to have a fabulous day. And at this time, I will introduce Richard C. Hoagland, who many of you are already familiar, who was a science advisor to Walter Cronkite, CBS. He, at 19, was curator of a couple of planetariums. He has been a writer. He's been an editor for Sky. Is it Star and Sky? I'll get it right. Magazine, and he is a fantastic researcher who is relentless in search of truth. And that's one of the things I really love about Richard. We've been friends for a good many years now, and I admire the way he methodically moves through information so that when we get through, when he's finished, we have the sequence of events that gives us the understanding so that we don't have to go back and ask too many more questions. And I know people like him to get to the point. You know, Art Bell's always saying, get to the point. But for me, I enjoy the ride of the sequence of events that precludes the climax. And so I just ask you to go with that as well. And join me in welcoming now Richard C. Hoagland.
I can see it now on my tombstone. They'll say he finally got to the point. But you see, there's this philosophy that the journey is sometimes more important than the destination. And I'm very process oriented. And what I really tried to do very consciously when I do art show is to give people enough process so they don't have to follow and take what I say as gospel. We have far too many gurus and far too few process people. And what I've been deliberately trying to do all these years is to lay out the fabric, the structure, so people can do it themselves. If you don't do that, what's the point? You know, I could be off selling storm windows or going to Polynesia or something. This morning, we're in for a kind of a change-up. Which, by the way, brings up something totally out of left field. Boy, the baseball metaphors are flying furious this morning, aren't they? Because I'm going to talk about baseball just for a second, all right? we have a tendency when we do these things, when we get involved in these discussions or in this kind of investigation, and we bring people together and we sit for a weekend and go through this kind of experience, to kind of, I mean, we're all in this room and there's a whole world out there, a whole planet. People are going to the beach, they're going down to the water, they're going out for picnics, they're going to baseball games, they're living life. And we have a tendency from wherever we are to think that it's the center of the universe and everything kind of flows from where we are and what we're doing. For 99.99% of the planet, perhaps even more, they're not even aware that we're in this room. They're not even aware of what we're talking about. They're not aware, like people were not aware in the 1930s, of what went on under the tennis courts in a place called Chicago, which forever changed the world. One of the things that I've tried to do is to describe for people things that you're not aware of that are going to change the world and change your life. Now, life can change for the better, or it can change for the worse. My feeling is if we empower people, if we get enough people looking at these problems and the options for dealing with them, that life can change for the better. But still, it's only going to be about 2%. Those people out there, the ones who were not here this morning, who opted, even if they knew about this, to, oh, it's a great day, we're going to go out to the ocean. Those people have voted not to have a vote. Because the things we're discussing are of such power and such seminal leverage that if they're properly applied, they can extraordinarily change things for the better. At the moment, the guys who are working with them, who we call, you know, kind of the deep black, the agencies, they're the ones that have the tools. And most Americans and most of the rest of the world doesn't even realize there are tools, let alone who has their hands on the levers of power to use them. So part of what we're trying to do is to bring people up the curve through things like this and through appearances on Bell and when I do television or, you know, put out the video series, to basically empower more and more people. And there's going to come a point with art. You know, he's done 6 of these experiments now, these thought experiments. Boy, does he have a set of surprises in store for him when I get finished, because there's some other things that are going to happen. All right, we are laying foundation, and we're laying foundation, I hope, in a very careful and calculated understanding. So instead of just going, as Tom said last night, with the feeling, when we get to that point where we ask 20 million people to do some things, they'll know a lot about why and what we're doing. And that's a staggering potential, which cannot be misused and must be very judiciously timed, so that when it's appropriate, we can do it. And we'll probably only get a chance to do it once or twice. But that's part of where we're going, this foundation, with everybody kind of coming up the curve, realizing this isn't just wishful thinking. There is a real physics here, the physics of changing reality. The other guys have had their innings. Now it's time for us to step up to the plate. Now, why am I using all these baseball metaphors? Because when it comes back to the real world, there's an extraordinary thing going on right now. There is a contest between Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire. And it's, I forget, I left, you know, a couple days ago. I've been cut off from the real world. I think today is the last day of the playoffs, unless the Cubs get a wild card slot or something. 37 years goes by, and the record is not broken. And then suddenly, in the space of 2 weeks, it's bang, 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 bang. And nobody is stopping to say, what's going on? Well, let me tell you what's going on. The physics is going on. Gravity is changing. That's why they're both hitting record home run after record home run. And when I get done with this and go back, I'm going to write a little paper for the web. I'm going to put it up there. Now, this has nothing to do with their expertise and acumen as sports, you know, figures. I mean, they deserve every ounce of credit, because out of how many in the major leagues, we only got 2. So they're the best. But the fact that they're breaking the records like that, no one is saying, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? And it's because the very physics of our environment. Remember when I said on Bell that there were four laboratories that had measured the gravitational constant and it was going down? Well, that was back about the time of the Olympics. And the day following, I had planned to write a little paper and look at all the records in the Olympics, all the jumping and the track and field, and where records are constantly being broken. The reason is that G is changing. If you feel a little lighter, it's because you are. Now, on Monday night last, when Tom and I did our show, we did it primarily because I'd sent a fax, which had been sent to me by Ken Johnston, who used to be a Seattleite and now is down where God lives, down in Albuquerque. And he had given me a heads up that JPL had measured, my old friend John Anderson had measured these distant spacecraft, the two Pioneers and Galileo and the Ulysses mission, and found for some bizarre reason that's inexplicable at the moment that gravity appears to be changing. That the gravitational constant in terms of the sun appears to be getting stronger. Well, of course, the lab data said it was getting weaker. That was an interesting conflict. So I wrote a paper and put it on the web. It's there now, where the enigma is resolved if the speed of light has fractionally changed. If light is now traveling slightly faster than it was when those missions were launched, which would give you the illusion of a higher gravitational field and bring the solar data into balance with the terrestrial data. The bottom line is, in the hyperdimensional physics model, one of the predictions is that as the physics changes, and it's cyclic, we're on an upswing and there will be eventually a downswing, and that's a long time coming because it's modulated by things very far out in the solar system, which take a long time to change. As the physics changes, as the scalar potentials change, to use a Beardenism, in the astrophysics, C must change, gravity must change, and they are inversely correlated. Speed of light goes up, gravity goes down. Gravity goes up, speed of light goes down. That, of course, has a tendency to throw certain people who are astronomers and celestial mechanics persons who are not very far away for a loop, because all their calculations are predicated on these things are constant. So part of why we do this is to bring our colleagues together so that they, who are also on their own search, on their own trail, have a chance to rub elbows and sit around and kibitz over lunch and dinner and all that, which is where at conferences the really good stuff happens, and kind of come up to speed on another set of disciplines. Because the world is so complex now, it's so incredibly complex, that it's impossible for any one person to keep their finger on everything, even if you, as I try to do, pride myself on being a generalist. There is literally too much to know. Now, the good news is we have the internet. The internet is the global brain. It's the global memory. It's amazing what you can now find on the internet. That's the good news. The bad news is there's a lot of junk on the internet. So how do you decide between real stuff and junk? It's called thinking. It's called process. It's called testing. It's called, it ain't going to be handed to you on a silver platter. You have got to figure it out. So what I'm trying to do consciously by doing these things over and over through the years is create a new kind of, I guess, university. Open university is one way of looking at it, for people who like to play in the ultimate game, which is thinking. Thinking about life, thinking about reality, thinking about how to make a difference, how to change it for the better. And we're not doing badly. And that leads me to what's on the screens here. Because we didn't really give this thing a name this weekend. Somebody said, what are you going to call it? I said, damn if I know. But as we were researching for this potential trip to the Middle East this winter, not next year. The Millennium mission is this winter. And in the afternoon, I'll show you why, all right? A title kind of came to mind, and it's taken directly from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is an interesting metaphor. I mean, NASA is using it, which I'm going to show this afternoon, so why not us? And I thought we would call the trip an odyssey of millions and millions of years, which comes from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, quote, the boat of millions of years. Now that, I got to thinking that this becomes, in essence, the first, this weekend becomes the first of a series of events leading up, Elaine, to that climax at the end of this year. So that's why last night, while we were having our interesting, very trivial discussion, I had a slide popped up there called the Millennium Mission. Because this is the Enterprise mission, but now we're focused on changing the preconceptions of the millennium. There's a tremendous amount of doom and gloom and fear and apprehension about the millennium. I mean, God, now we got to worry about the damn computers. I mean, doesn't anything stand still? Can't we count on anything? And the answer is yes. But we have to think big enough. And what we've been able to do is to assemble some folks for this weekend who, if anything, can never be accused of thinking small. And would you like this for a segue? Speaking of not thinking small, Tom Van Flandern has been thinking of how to blow solar systems to kingdom come for a long time. It was only of late, in the last, I would say, maybe 5 or 6 years, that I got his brilliant attention focused, I'm not quite sure how it happened, on a problem that I thought was kind of important, that in the beginning I didn't know was connected, and now I feel is inextricably connected with his search, and that's the Cydonia problem. And through a very separate path, and this is another thing you should look for, if people come together and say exactly the same thing, you know, they're probably copying. But if they come together, focus on the same thing, and they've come from different roots, then you really can trust what you're hearing, because every one of us is different. We all process differently. But if we wind up going to Rome by another road, and we wind up in Rome, that's telling us something. Because it means that there's really something at the end of the road. In this case, it's Cydonia. So I've watched rather with some self-satisfaction Tom come up the Cydonia curve all by his lonesome, and to have come up with some important original data and processing and analysis all by his lonesome. Because that's, of course, how I started on this particular road. We went through what I call the Martian doorway. Tom Bearden has gone through the alternative physics doorway. I went through the Martian doorway, but another doorway down the hall. And it took a turn through the lunar doorway and then through the geometry doorway. And there's a lot of doorways in this place. It's almost like a hall of mirrors, because the other side is putting up mirrors and false doors so that you go through a door and, whoops, like Art the other night, there's no porch. You heard how he described his little accident, an NDE, no deck experience. He came that close. And it was almost a tragedy, a double tragedy, because he had been talking a few minutes before about John Holloman and his incredibly tragic accident. So we can't count on tomorrow, but we can plan for tomorrow. And if we plan hard enough, we can change tomorrow. And that's what this is all about. It's about changing tomorrow so it works for everybody. So let me introduce someone who I am very pleased to know, to have worked with, to have argued with. We're going to have a great argument this afternoon. At the end of the afternoon. I have a nice surprise for Tom. I would like you to give a warm welcome to a fellow Cydonia researcher. Did I ever think I'd be saying that? Dr. Thomas Van Flandern.
Thank you very much for those kind introductory remarks, Dick. Talk this morning will deal with the connections between the exploded planet hypothesis that was discussed yesterday and the Cydonia region on Mars, and ultimately what it all means to us here on Earth. In this morning's presentation, to demark the different sections of this talk, I've chosen some very brief musical excerpts from the musical War of the Worlds, narrated by Richard Burton.
In the last years of the 19th century, that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with the microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
That also shows advantages of staying current in the technology. This is being driven by a 486, and it's a bit slow for what I'm trying to push it to do. Yesterday, I concluded with this slide, the conclusion of Gilbert Levine, the principal investigator on the Viking labeled release experiment on the Viking lander on Mars in 1976. And after 22 years of analysis about all the possible interpretations, all the objections that were raised, and a review of the data taken and the conclusions that must be drawn from the design of the experiment and the controls applied to it, Gilbert Levine concluded the Viking label release experiment detected living organisms in the soil of Mars. No longer any qualifiers on that conclusion, and that's current, not microfossils as in the Mars meteorite, tiny things from billions of years ago. That's current. So let me just, with that transition from the conclusion of yesterday's talk, let me turn to the subject of Cydonia. The subject, then, to continue the Odyssey, is the features of the Cydonia region on Mars. First, let's briefly review what was known before the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft. The thing that attracted our attention to Cydonia in the first place was that two investigators noticed a hominid face surrounded by a headdress in that region of Mars. Then nearby were a cluster of pyramidal objects and some small unusual raised mounds called the City, a large four- or five-sided pyramid called the DiPietro and Molinar Pyramid after the two astronomer discoverers, something called the Fort or Fortress, with linear wall-like features and several other nearby anomalies. Pictorially, this is what the face looked like in the original Viking photos. Only half of it was in sunlight, the other half hidden in shadows. But we could see an unusual degree of symmetry and face-like appearance, although since this is something found after is noticed but unexpected, there is no way to be sure whether you're seeing a chance pattern that happens to resemble a face or whether this was something that was designed to look this way. Here is the face in the context of the City with the D&M pyramid just off the bottom of the picture and the fortress just to the upper left, upper right here of the City. This is the fortress feature. And this is the D&M pyramid. It could be a damaged five-sided object. Suspicions are, though, that it was originally a four-sided object, and whatever made this large crater here, a very unusual crater, extremely deep for any kind of impact crater, but whatever made that may have actually damaged the pyramid, split the side here, and possibly even melted a substantial portion of the rock, producing this melt pool surrounding it only on this side. Here is a view of the fortress and its unusual triangular courtyard, and it's triangular on both the exterior and the interior. And there appears to be a ramp up from the desert floor on the west side here to the top of the wall-like feature. We do not have any idea what this feature would look like at high resolution, because Mars Global Surveyor attempted to image it at high resolution on it for its third and final image back in April, but was unsuccessful. It just missed off to the west. At this point, with these images from Viking, we had some curious artificiality indicators, and eight different tests of artificiality of the area had been proposed at that time. Regarding the face, NASA had suggested that it was just a trick of light and shadow, but it was learned already from the Viking photos that the face was actually a three-dimensional contour that way, and not just a flat photo-like impression or merely a two-dimensional profile or any kind of light and shadow simulation, but that it actually was shaped three-dimensionally with the eye socket carved out and so on, and the nose ridge upraised. Which were all in agreement with the idea that it might have been designed rather than that it was a chance formation. The fractal test Richard mentioned in detail yesterday, even objective computer software designed by the military to find man-made objects in camouflage registered this object as high on the artificiality scale when applied to it, so it doesn't. It's not just humans who find that object intriguing. Objective computer software also sees it as unusual. The nearby small mounds are non-randomly distributed, and statistical tests of their distribution. That conclusion led to the idea that either they were designed or some kind of unknown enigmatic geology was going on, and the proximity to other unique and anomalous objects indicated that you had a context suggesting artificiality. So at that point, of the eight tests that had been suggested to determine whether or not artificiality was present in Cydonia, four of the tests were passed. The bilateral symmetry result was unknown at that time, and three of the tests were indicating most likely a random or non-culturally significant object. But there were some additional developments in the following years as more and more attention was paid to this area by a group of investigators. The Society for Planetary SETI Research brought together a number of individuals who donated their time. No one was funded for any of this work. And they came up with some additional image processing and analysis that brought out additional information regarding the tests. The most significant of those was the bilateral symmetry test. In the original view, we did not know what was in the shadowed side, and an obvious test of high significance would be that if the object was chance in any way, if this was just a mountain or a formation that nature had made and it happened to look like a face, then the unseen, the shadowed side would certainly be random. It would be a pile of rocks, sand, craters, anything but another half of a face. Whereas if and only if this thing had been built by someone to resemble a face, would you expect to see the other half looking like a mirror image of the first half? Well, we can't say that it was a mirror image, but it was certainly, to my eye, much more like The matching half of the face that we would have thought, would have expected to find if this were an artificial object, then it looked like a random pile of rocks or sand or craters. When the image processing enabled us to bring up some details on the shadowed side. Clearly there are some asymmetries, something in this area, suggesting that perhaps there was an impact crater or something producing some asymmetry from the original, but it was what I would consider a pass for artificiality on the bilateral symmetry test, and that had a high statistical significance. It certainly got my attention. And then there was another development that not only got my attention, but that I felt shifted the balance of evidence so strongly in favor of artificiality that the further investigation of Cydonia ought to be a top priority of scientists. That was the result of one of the Bell appearances I did with Richard some time ago. And after that show, when we had talked about exploding planets and Comet Hale-Bopp and Mars as a former moon of Planet V, a listener wrote an email and he said, well, what about a possible Cydonia tie-in? If Mars was a former moon and its pole shifted by 90 degrees, as you mentioned, then where was the where was Cydonia with respect to the former location of the pole of Mars? And I understood immediately why he asked that question and what the significance of it was, because the cultural significance tests that were showing that this was a random feature suggested that if this had been built by someone, first you'd expect them, if they wanted it to look like a face to anyone, they'd have built it upright rather than tipped over 30 degrees to one side. And secondly, you'd expect them to build it some place where it could be seen from above, because you can't see this as a face from ground level anywhere on Mars. So it's been, nor can you see it from any other planet, it's too far away. So it's meant for somebody up above in the atmosphere or in space. And therefore, if you're building this to be seen from space, you would undoubtedly want to build it on the equator so it can be seen no matter what direction you're coming from space. Whereas any other location, it would be hidden for certain approach directions. Or just build it someplace like the highest point on Mars, or someplace that's culturally significant and functionally significant. So those tests were indicating that the object was random, since it didn't meet either of those criteria, and therefore it appeared to be functionally useless and pointless with respect to any imaginable, I mean, just the most basic thing, just looking like a face. It should at least be upright. Well, I knew that the previous location of the pole of Mars had been published in the standard literature by Martian geologists, Peter Schultz, who was doing an investigation of features on the surface of Mars that had nothing to do with Cydonia, nothing to do with exploding planets, but he had found evidence that there was a previous location of the pole of Mars based on a number of unique pole-like surface features found at another location. And when he found those, he immediately looked 180 degrees away and found more of the same, indicating that both the north and the south poles were indeed opposite one another and at a geographically different place on Mars at an unknown time in the past than they are at present. And moreover, that there was a very sudden shift between the two poles, because there was no indication of intermediate positions of the poles in between. So I looked up the coordinates that he had for the old pole and quickly did the calculations. And to my amazement, and I must really say shock at that point, I found that the face was, when we did the calculations, within a tenth of a degree of the old equator that Peter Schultz had indicated in the literature from his pole position. That's closer than the uncertainty in the pole position, so there's a bit of serendipity there, but the point is that to the accuracy that we could tell, this object had been built right on the old equator of Mars. And so I quickly did the orientation calculation, and the same shocking result, the face was upright at that time. The nose bridge was perfectly north-south, perpendicular to the equator, at the time that was the equator of Mars. Not just the face, seen here in the lower right, but there are four objects in the Cydonia region, all of which are of similar size, and there are major features in all four of them that have an almost identical orientation, which is tilted about 30 degrees west of north at present, as you see in these photos, but all of which were upright with respect to the old equator when that was in play. Yes, 22 and a half, yes. That's right. Yes, you're right about that. And Dick was the first to put the angle down correctly in his book, Monuments of Mars. So this was not just a significant angle for the face, but it was a significant angle for the Cydonia complex. Again, suggesting not only artificiality, but a tie-in between these various features. This gave me quite a few weeks to rethink my own paradigms, because I felt that this evidence, as I said, I stopped short of saying that it was compelling, but it certainly was statistically significant, and shifted the balance of evidence in the direction of convincing me that Cydonia ought to be a top priority for further research. And so I was very pleased when NASA announced in March that they were going to take some additional photos with the MGS spacecraft. This is just an overview of the Cydonia complex with the old equator drawn in for perspective. And you can see in here, the face is this little object right up here. My gyro mouse gets disoriented occasionally. Lane suggests it's the air on Mars. All right, now. Just to the 10 o'clock angle from my pointer is the face, just above the equator there. All right, so now we have the situation that all eight tests proposed by the group of independent researchers were registering artificiality, some of them strongly so. And what were we to do with that? Go to NASA, persuade them to give this priority, and the amazing thing is they agreed. Very reluctantly, to be sure, and in fact really only certain elements in NASA agreed. The JPL team was opposed to this vociferously, and we understand they had to be cajoled and bribed into going along and taking the pictures, but take them they did, however reluctantly. And I'm uncomfortable because there's a mix of confidential and public communications there. So their public record shows that they were extremely reticent and reluctant to take these pictures, declaring it a waste of public funds and researcher time. Okay, so now the segue to the next section of MGS. Let's see. Do we have probably sound got turned off after the last glitch? Do we have any sound? Okay, let me back up and replay that. Mars Global Surveyor took these three strip images. This is just a brief reminder of where the three strips fell, and the largest and widest of the strips, only because it was taken from a far greater distance and far more oblique angle, was the one that that captured the face. The face initially did not look much like the one that we'd seen in the Viking photos. And this is the original Viking photo, and the other two views are views of the MGS face. Contrast is a little too poor, I think, to see the detail on here. But the point is that initially we had to spend quite a bit of time figuring out what the relationship was between the new object that was shown to us in these images and the object we'd seen before in Viking. Because we weren't given critical information in the first analysis and with the first images, such as that the spacecraft did pass far to the west. It was not an overhead view. It was shot with the face practically looking out toward the horizon. With the sun light coming from an even lower angle from the opposite side, so that we were looking at the shadowed side, and we were looking at such a low look angle that we were only seeing half the mesa and could not see much beyond the nose ridge. Yes.
As a celestial mechanic,
that's
credited as wasn't there a way to phase the bird so the first image, 20-30
years, was the exact match of Viking? Well, Dick asked if they couldn't have gotten an overhead orbit. That would have required a burn and use of fuel and doing spacecraft actual orbital maneuvering, which they have not done for any other image.
But they didn't set up the orbit. They didn't. So every 9 days they passed over the site. All right? And they set up the phase order, that first image over Sedona could have been right over the top. It all depends on your parameters. When they did the burn, after they stopped air braking, they had to do a burn.
After they stopped aerobraking, they had an orbit with the closest point to Mars a bit south of Cydonia, and as it drifted so that the closest point was more or less at the latitude of Cydonia, they said, all right, now is our opportunity if we're ever going to photograph this. And they just took whatever orbit, whatever opportunities came along at that point. The first one, there was no point in making special efforts for the first one because they weren't convinced they were going to get it. As you know, Merton Davies started with an almost 20-kilometer error in the location of the zero meridian of longitude, and they had to basically work their way in so they would even have it in the field of view. And they were very comfortable with the idea of an oblique angle because it greatly increased their chances of getting it in the field of view. As you know, in the later pass where they were trying to get the fortress and were looking straight down and the field of view was much narrower, they missed. And they were afraid that would happen with the face, so the oblique view at least allowed them to get it in the field. And I guess the reasoning was if there was anything there that justified a further view, there were going to be other opportunities. Actual orbital maneuvering, which they have not done for any other image.
But they did it to set up the orbit. They did it so every 9 days they passed over the site. Alright? And set up the phase order, that first image over Sedona could have been right over the top. It all depends on your parameters. When they did the burn, after they stopped aerobraking, they had to do a burn.
After they stopped aerobraking, they had an orbit with the closest point to Mars a bit south of Cydonia, and as it drifted so that the closest point was more or less at the latitude of Cydonia, they said, all right, now is our opportunity if we're ever going to photograph this. And they just took whatever orbit, whatever opportunities came along at that point. The first one, there was no point in making special efforts for the first one because they weren't convinced they were going to get it. As you know, Merton Davy started with an almost 20-kilometer error in the location of the zero meridian of longitude, and they had to basically work their way in so they would even have it in the field of view. And they were very comfortable with the idea of an oblique angle because it greatly increased their chances of getting it in the field of view. As you know, in the later pass where they were trying to get the fortress and were looking straight down and the field of view was much narrower, they missed. And they were afraid that would happen with the face, so the oblique view at least allowed them to get it in the field. And I guess the reasoning was if there was anything there that justified a further view, there were going to be other opportunities. Of course, we wound up only getting half in the sense that we can't see over the nose ridge, but at least it was all in the field of view. So this is a larger view of what MGS saw without any corrections or reorientations. And again, we are only seeing half of the mesa, but the visually striking in this image is the entire surrounding the wall-like feature that divides this mesa from the very flat desert that goes on for many hundreds of square kilometers around it with hardly a glitch, and then suddenly rising out of this desert with walls a couple hundred meters high up to the mesa where you have this interesting structure. And then the features. It took a while to figure out what were the features as they corresponded to Viking, but in the next image, I have drawn them in with pen to make it obvious, even though I'm no artist, and therefore it looks a bit cartoonish. But that the circular image there is the eyeball socket. The two straight lines demark the nose ridge. The other two lines at the bottom denote the lips that are seen on the half we can see. We know from that Viking image that the mouth feature does go through to the other side, but we cannot see any trace of that in the MGS image because we can't see across the crest of the mesa. And likewise, the other eye socket, we can see clearly in the Viking image that there is another eye socket over there. We can only see a hint of it in this image because it is pretty much blocked by the nose ridge. So we have to content ourselves with half a face. But in that half a face, the most remarkable thing happened. We saw not just the features that Vikings saw, that is, an eye socket, a nose, and apparently a mouth, but we saw detailed secondary facial characteristics just where they would have to be if this was an attempt by someone to portray a face. So, in addition to the things seen in Viking, we saw this feature above the eye socket. We could only see that there was something there in the Viking imagery. I wondered at one time if it was some sort of a pyramid sitting on the forehead. We now see it in high detail, and it looks like an eyebrow feature. We see inside of the eye socket a circular feature, which apparently is an attempt to portray a pupil. And we see at the end of the nose ridge two circular features that seem to be nostrils. These are my drawings. They don't look quite this good. I'll show you the close-up views of each of these in a moment. But they're good enough that they are apparently deliberate. And the mouth was just a single dark shadow before. Now we see it resolved into parted lips. There's even additional detail between the nose and the mouth suggesting a septum in the face design. In other words, quite a bit of secondary detail
too much to ignore, I think, with regard to the artificiality hypothesis. Now, before showing the high-resolution detail, I need to make the distinction that scientists are taught to make so that they can tell the difference between statistically significant patterns and ones that are not significant. These are parts of what are called the scientific method. And the scientific method has its rules and is to be contrasted with what I have dubbed the unscientific method, which seems to be the one in popular use both among members of the public and, sadly to say, among most scientists today. This consists of acausal patterns, acausal coincidences, and acausal associations. I usually elaborate a bit more on what these mean, but let me just give you one example. You take you're scheduled to fly, and when you approach the airport and are boarding, the thought flashes through your mind, feeling a little nervous about this flight. You have in your mind a scenario of the flight crashing and what it would mean to your family and so on. During the flight, experiences technical difficulties, an engine flames out or something, and you land safely, but you realize that you had a premonition, and that is powerfully registered in your mind that you had a premonition before this flight, and sure enough, something happened. Is that significant? And the answer is no, it is not even a little bit. It turns out that not just you, but nearly everyone, except the most hardened flyers, has such premonitions and scenarios virtually every time they fly, but naturally they quickly put them out of their minds once the flight has proceeded safely, because you don't like to think back on your apprehensions and dwell on them. So this is an example of selective memory, where you try to forget unpleasant memories that have no significance to you, but if there is an apparent significance that develops after the fact, then that memory becomes fixed in your mind for the rest of your life, and you always remember that. But nonetheless, it happened after the fact. That is, identifying the causal effect was something you did afterwards, not something you could predict in advance. So you have to go back, and the next time you go to the airport and you have an apprehension about a flight, you have to say to yourself, I'm having an apprehension. If this flight proceeds safely, I'll know that that apprehension was meaningless. And, of course, almost all the time, that is the outcome. So it is finding associations like that that come under these acausal patterns, coincidences, and associations categories. And I'm afraid we all have a strong tendency to do that, because it's very discomforting to admit that there are simply random events and occurrences. We like to think it's all part of a design, all part of a plan, all under someone's control. And often that's not the case. So we're always looking for patterns and meaning, often where there is none. Scientists are trained to use a set of rules to determine whether or not there is, in fact, an element of genuine predictability in an apparent pattern or association that is found. Part of that consists of reality testing, which is something scientists learned to do early on. And this is the distinguishing of things that occur only in the mind versus things that are in objective external reality, such that others can also see and verify them from their own independent experience. The trouble with things, however real, that can only be seen by ourselves and can't be seen by others, is that human beings do and can hallucinate. They can and do dream, but they can have hallucinations so vivid that it is impossible to tell the difference between a hallucination and what you're actually seeing with your eyes. Not all of us can do that, at least not without drug-induced enhancements, but many people who suffer from schizophrenia have those kind of illusions regularly, and it's a part of the reality they have to live with, that they will have hallucinations so real that they can't distinguish between what is actually coming into their eyes from their reality and what their mind is creating on their visual mind screen. So because this is a part of our reality, it is very important for anything that we think is real to exist in objective external reality, and for that we have to be able to find instrumental tests that can measure it or confirm it, or other people who can confirm it, to be sure that it is indeed real. Controls are an important part of scientific method, which means that you have to make sure that not only is the pattern you see significant, but that that if you control all the variables involved there, that only the cause and effect in the hypothesis works, but not any other direction. Otherwise, the effect you're seeing might be for some completely unrelated cause, and you would be fooled in your association. Then there are question of extraordinary hypotheses. And the difficulty with that one, Richard elaborated on very nicely yesterday, that if you move, if you use this criterion, you can constantly move the goalposts. As originally designed, this was intended to say that hypotheses should not violate known observational or experimental constraints or known laws of physics. However, it has gone on to be applied in such a way as to change the criteria for what constitutes acceptable evidence for anything that is merely surprising, and that's not really fair under scientific method. And lastly is the most important point for understanding cydonia. It's the issue of a priori versus a posteriori, and what that basically means is, if you discover a pattern, no matter how amazing, after the fact, you have to dismiss it, at least as a working hypothesis, as merely chance, because one in a billion coincidences can and do occur all the time when events have a billion possibilities to occur. When there are a billion events, one in a billion of them is going to be a one in a billion event. As someone remarked, every single poker hand, even though the odds of, let's see, I don't mean poker. What's another game where you deal all 13 cards? Bridge. All right. Yes. Every bridge hand has something like 1 in 500 billion odds against being dealt that particular hand. But of course, once you're dealt it, it becomes an a posteriori fact that you got dealt those cards, and the fact that it was 1 in 500 billion odds of getting that particular hand is irrelevant. And that remains equally true if you were dealt 13 spades or a fairly random-looking hand. It's still 1 in 500 billion odds, but you're certain to get one of them with those 1 in 500 billion possibilities. So after the fact, you can't tell anything. But if before the fact, the odds are very long against something happening, but you predict the cause and effect, and say, I think this is going to happen anyway, even though the odds of it's happening by chance are fairly negligible, then if it does happen as you predict, that's significant, and scientists are supposed to pay attention to that hypothesis. That doesn't prove the hypothesis, but it raises it to the elevation of a scientific hypothesis and is deserving then of further investigation by scientists. And the degree of certainty attached to either verifying or falsifying the hypothesis is in accord with the success or failure of the predictions it makes and the odds of their happening by chance. So as this applies to Cydonia, what is significant is that it was a posteriori when we found a face, something that looked like a face, in the Viking images in 1976. That can happen by chance. You can and do find things that look like faces in clouds, in the Old Man in the Mountain in New Hampshire, and in other places throughout our reality and in the solar system. But now that your attention has been directed to that, and you set up hypotheses and get additional data with information that you could not have known and was not part of forming your hypothesis, we get, for example, the MGS images with 10 times better resolution, and we say we're trying to distinguish now with this better resolution between the two hypotheses. This is a natural formation that by chance looks like a face versus this was built by someone. Now you have an a priori hypothesis, and the a priori hypothesis that this was built by someone says there's going to be additional detail here that will enhance the image of the view of it as a face versus the natural hypothesis says as we get higher resolution, this is going to look more random and more unnatural, more like nature's handiwork than it did in the view we had before. And what we actually found with Mars Global Surveyor was the secondary facial characteristics, which should only be there if this thing was designed by someone to look like a face. There are two parts to performing this test. The first is the existence of secondary facial features having the correct size, shape, location, and orientation on the mesa to be portrayals of secondary facial characteristics. We'll look at each of these, each of the four major ones, one at a time. The second part of the test is the control. There must not be other features of the same size or shape or similar appearance elsewhere on the mesa or indeed elsewhere around the landscape from which we can pick and choose ones that fit our mental preconception of what a face ought to look like. Both parts of that test are passed in spades in Cydonia here on the face mesa. Here is the eyebrow feature, and we see that it is made of three fairly linear sides, as shown in the inset at the bottom. That already is a rather remarkable thing, to have a triangle with linear sides joined at the at three apexes. Triangles don't arise very much in nature. There was a triangular feature on the moon in the Ukert crater near the center of the moon's disk that led to a lot of speculation that might be an artificial object, maybe doing some sort of monitoring of the Earth. But when the Clementine mission got close-up photographs of it, it looked very meandering and very rounded apexes and very irregular, not at all linear sides. It looked natural, in other words. In this case, we have a close-up view, and we have rather strikingly linear sides and strikingly angular apexes in the eyebrow feature, and it has the correct size, shape, location, and orientation to be an attempt to portray an eyebrow. Here is the pupil feature inside of the eyeball contour on the face, as seen in the inset there. The outer is just an outline of the contour intending to portray the eye, and the inner circle is the apparent circular feature intending to portray a pupil. Now, obviously, Think what it would mean. Just think ahead. If we had a photograph of the other side of the mesa, just behind the nose ridge, where there ought to be another eye socket with another pupil and another eyebrow there, we can't see over there. We see a suggestion of another eyebrow sticking up behind the nose ridge, but the distortion is too great, and the view of the eyeball is completely cut off. But if we had this kind of resolution there, and there was indeed another triangular eyebrow, another eyeball, and another pupil there, what are the odds of those things happening by chance? Obviously negligible. So are the odds of this happening by chance, and basically this is an a priori prediction. We were trying to distinguish artificial from natural going in, and so already this is significant. But wouldn't we love to have those additional pictures? Here are the here's the close-up of the mouth feature showing the parted lips. This was just no trick of light and shadow. It's actually a ravine there, a gully between the two. And the continuation down the other side of the mesa can be seen very faintly, but there's almost no contrast available on the sunlit side for reasons Richard remarked on yesterday. And finally, at the end of the at the end of the nose ridge, we have the two circular features. Let's see, in this area, that appear. Richard showed a better view of this yesterday. They appear to be attempts to portray nostrils in the nose, which is itself tapered toward the forehead, just as a humanoid face would have. The additional detail there is striking in that it again has the nostril features and the contours of the nose have the correct location, orientation, and shape to be in a deliberate attempt to portray details in a face. This is an overview, but now corrected by using the known elevation information from Viking so as to reconstruct an overhead view. This was done by Mark Carlotto. And when we put the features on the west side back in their correct perspective that they would have if seen from overhead, the features on the east side are blank because we can't see them. So they're in this corrected view, we're just filling in blank there. But when we put them back in their correct perspective from an overhead view, the nose ridge is north and south. That is, I should say, it's north and south with respect to the old equator. Here it's parallel to the sides of the enclosure to within 2 degrees. So it is the, and it's the bisector of the mesa. It is going right down the middle of the mesa. Moreover, the orientation of the whole face is very good with respect to the enclosure itself. The enclosure having a smoothly rounded bottom, linear sides, a linear top, and right angles in the two top corners. This is an artificial view in which we have taken the real west side and mirrored it to the east side. And the point of doing this is to say, if and when we get that kind of detail on the east side, we might, if it hadn't been a bit damaged and eroded, we might have seen something like this. And if we take this view and in the computer back off, look at it from a low western perspective and a highly oblique angle and illuminate it from the opposite side from a low angle to the southeast, we do indeed reconstruct something very much like what MGS actually saw. So this is sort of what potentially could be there if we only had an overhead view of the entire mesa. And certainly that is much too strikingly symmetric to have been a chance formation by nature. So this leads us to the conclusions of an analysis that does adhere closely to the rules of scientific method for the face mesa. and that includes distinguishing a priori from a posteriori patterns and coincidences. It includes controls, and it includes using only statistical odds that were that can be established independently of ad hoc determinations after you see things. The combination of the individual size, shape, location, and orientation, I'm not going to give you the individual breakdown of this number, but for each of the secondary facial features that were a priori predictions and found to be in the those with those correct features, the a priori odds against that combined were 10 to the 30 to 1. That includes the a priori odds against bilateral symmetry as well, buried in that figure. And that combined with the fact that that there are no other features in the noisy in any noisy background that could be used to pick and choose the ones that favor the hypothesis gives us the conclusion that scientists are, by the rules of scientific method, obliged to accept the hypothesis as passing this test of artificiality. That doesn't mean that artificiality is at all guaranteed, because you can't prove a hypothesis. You can only falsify one. But what this means is that the natural origin hypothesis is falsified at the statistical level of 10 to the 30th to 1. What else could it be besides artificial? Well, before you get to odds of 10 to the 30th to 1, NASA could be faking the whole space program. I'll give you better odds than 10 to the 30th to 1 on that possibility, but a less conspiratorial view would be something was done with these faces by some prankster, although that's not supposed to have been able to happen given the controls they claimed were in place. But nonetheless, even though you can't prove a hypothesis ever in science, you can disprove a hypothesis, and the natural origin hypothesis is disproved at this statistical significance level. And that was what led to my statement that I think that now the conclusion of artificiality is established beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore, in my opinion, NASA faking the whole space program is not a reasonable thing to have suspicions about. The entire space program, now I'm talking about. Yes. That was not an a priori prediction, and therefore, even if we found it to be true, it would be a posteriori. One has to be very careful and. I understand the information was there in advance, but you have to apply it in such a way that A implies C, but not A does not allow C to occur either. And so if the prediction had been made in such a way that if it's golden ratio, then it's artificial, if it's not, then it's not, and you'd accept a natural origin, then you can claim significance for that. Otherwise, you just say afterwards, well, yes, this goes along, and I'm about to do that with several more features here at Cydonia. I'm about to say, here are some lots of other things that are dead giveaways of artificiality there, but they're all a posteriori. Therefore, we can't use them to establish the artificiality hypothesis. But given the artificiality of the face, these things suddenly become significant. So they apply. Yeah, that's right. So we have to carefully distinguish between things that establish the hypothesis versus things that flow from the hypothesis once it has been established at a reasonable level. No, I didn't. yes, I guess that's a fair criticism, but when scientists are taught to be conservative, and the main thing that a scientist is supposed to guard against is being fooled in his hypothesis testing. And there's a lot of that going around, frankly, and ultimately, when someone is going to come along and challenge the Big Bang and start suggesting planets blowing up and so on, how do you decide when you really are have crossed the line and become a crank? to be very frank about it, at one point in my career, I had to stop and ask myself, "Wait a minute." So many people write to me with ideas that are obviously off the wall, and that's exactly the way many of my colleagues regard me. Why should I be so arrogant as to think that the ideas I think are interesting are not in the same category? And the answer to that question I found was strict adherence to the rules of scientific method. It is a theory, but it is nonetheless the theory of the collective wisdom of mankind of how anyone can tell a true thing from a false one. And these are the rules that are set up designed to keep us from fooling ourselves. And frankly, that's what almost everyone does, including almost every scientist. And it wasn't until I had applied all of the rules and the controls to make sure that I wasn't fooling myself and put that in front of my colleagues and found that they had no answers that I felt the confidence to go forward myself with my own ideas. So, yes, it may be like a lawyer, but how else can one be sure that one isn't a fool? This is one of the other nearby mesas, and although it doesn't have an object on it that we can identify, in fact, it looks like different objects from different orientations, it also has the same kind of enclosure as at Cydonia, an asymmetric one, coming right out of a stark background desert. And given the context of what we see in the surroundings and the artificiality of the nearby face, I'm going to show you a couple of quick snapshots of different views from the area that suggest to me that we have a number of mesas and objects portrayed in the Cydonia region that suggest a kind of purpose to the whole area. On the lower, let me go back for just a moment to put this in context. In the extreme lower right portion of the enclosure, there are some tiny white stripes, which I'll show in the close-up view in that next slide. These are what have been called variously tracks or other kinds of features, but these unusual parallel white lines. And there are a few examples of this around the Cydonia region. In the case of this particular mesa, going back again, it occurs to me that the functional purpose these might serve is that they sort of give a glow to the image on the mesa, like a halo, so kind of offsetting it from the desert surroundings. And it's possible that originally these were all around the mesa, but on the sides where the wind-blown sand piles up, that they've been almost completely obliterated, and only on the places where the wall is high on the leeward side, where no wind or sand piles up, do we see the underlying patterns still surviving. Another nearby feature just below that is equally remarkable with a series of parallel white lines, apparently intended to offset features. Hundreds of meters. Let me go back one here. This one is a little harder to see, in fact, possibly impossible, given the lighting conditions we have here. But this is a set of four embedded triangles, the largest of which practically fills the screen. And the second one is about half that toward the lower left. Oh, thank you. Let's see. Well, we have... Okay, the largest one is here. I don't know if you can see that at all from the audience. This next one is here. There's one here, and then a smallest triangle yet. Four embedded triangles. Triangles are pretty rare shapes to find in nature. And a series of four embedded ones, again, a posteriori. We can't use it to prove artificiality, but given that it's here at Cydonia, that the face is nearby, it's artificial beyond a reasonable doubt, in my opinion. I think that these are significant and indications of activity and purposefulness in the Cydonia area. Here's another curiosity. This is three views of the same thing progressively with increased contrast and then magnified. The first view shows the sloping face of one of the pyramids. It's remarkably bright given the low sun angle and almost smooth, glassy or metallic in overall appearance with the very bright reflections off that face are so close to 100% albedo that they almost look like specular reflections. On this mesa, over here is an unusual-looking striped thing. These appear to be a little too dark to see details. I'm sorry. We really need a brighter projector to be able to see details for this kind of audience, but I can only describe what's there that you could see if you were looking at a... if any of you have internet access, you can find these on the website, the Meta Research website, which I'll give the link to at the end, and you see a high-resolution view of them. In this case, there's something with parallel black and white stripes alternating in this area, which is seen in a magnified view down here. And for those of you on this side, let's see, it's there's my pointer. It's in this area and then magnified down here. What's interesting about it is not so much the shape, which looks sort of like some sort of a Gila monster. I don't think that there's a 500-meter Gila monster walking by the camera on Mars at the time, but whatever it is, there is an almost identical shape right behind it, but fainter. And it looks, for all the world, to me like a reflection of the first one. And this goes along with the thought that the surface behind it is almost glassy or metallic. Can't prove that. It's a posteriori. Take a look at it on the laptop. You can see it better on the laptop.
Sagan did that once at a Viking meeting.
That's an overview of a couple of the things we see there. I'm going to show you a few more in a moment, but now I wanted to go back to our exploded planet hypothesis and the Mars-Moon link tie-in.
Chances of anything coming from Mars are million to one, he said. Chances
chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one. But still, they come.
In the musical War of the Worlds, that's the astronomer who said the chances of anything coming from Mars were a million to one. This is just a quick review of what we noted yesterday about Mars being a former moon of planet V, the planet probably where the life that is found in those meteorites originally evolved, and in the, for that matter, the life in the soil samples on Mars today may not be endemic to Mars and may not have evolved there, but may be transplanted from the explosion. Since Mars was a moon and was accumulated quite a bit of debris from the parent planet at the time of the explosion. Just reviewing what we mentioned yesterday, the strong hemispheric crustal dichotomy of Mars, the offset of the center of mass and center of figure, the sudden shift of the pole by 90 degrees, the Tharsis bulge with the volcanoes at the location of the new equator, the original dense atmosphere is mostly gone. Just a tiny fragment of it remains today. Fission byproducts that show an excess on Mars, indicative of a major explosion, but affecting Mars more than anything else. Therefore, Mars had to be relatively close. These are all indicators that Mars was a moon of the planet when it blew up. And we can imagine the dilemma if there had been intelligent life at that time. They would have been faced with some tough decisions. So let me hold that thought for just a moment, show you just a couple of additional features from Cydonia, and then I'll tie it all together. Here is an additional image from one of the other tracks taken in the Cydonia region. And let's see. I don't know how well these show up. It's harder and harder to see detail the further back you go. But here from the stage, even, I have a hard time seeing some of this detail. This is a face seen in profile elsewhere on the Cydonia region. There is a hairline here, a forehead, an eye in that region, a nose, a mouth, an ear here, a fairly complete profile view of a face. Here is another object in Cydonia, which is brought out here by computer coloration, showing what appears to be something we might describe, say, as a dolphin. This is from a section that seems to show sea-like objects throughout that region. There is another section, I think this image was shown yesterday with the hexagonal crater, and there is an object in this vicinity that looks like a snake coming out of a basket. Right nearby is this object that looks something like a scorpion. This appears to be the reptile section, insect section of the area. The Gila monster might have been in the reptile section. Here is an interesting object. There's three views of the same thing. This shows the context. This shows a close-up of the object as seen by MGS. And this is enhanced by an artist to show what apparently is there. That is just connecting lines that seem to be faded from overlay of sand on the object. Apparently there's enough detail there that just connecting lines already there but interrupted gives you that last view, which looks like some sort of an antlered creature, perhaps a large moose or something, and this in the land animals area of Cydonia. These are suggestive images, and again, a posteriori, but there are a lot of these around. You can see in the context image over here that there's another object down here, which is also apparently attempt to portray something in the sand. This leads to speculations, and I feel it's important to distinguish speculations from scientific conclusions. But given the scientific conclusion, which is that artificiality of the face is established beyond a reasonable doubt, if you're not there with me yet, then you're not ready to go to the speculations. But if you are, this is an interesting part. What does it mean? Well, any what, please?
Ears?
haven't found those yet, but we have a lot more of Cydonia to photograph. Cydonia might be some sort of a theme park, not I think intended for us, but for the natives of Planet V, perhaps, for whom the year-long trip to Earth would be too expensive and too long to take. Not very many of the natives could afford to take such a trip at their own expense. And there might be, therefore, a purpose to having a local themed park that they could visit. This is pure speculation, but we do see a lot of oddly, distinctly terrestrial things in Cydonia. And it's beyond, I think, just our associations. These things don't look alien. They look terrestrial. And, in fact, the face itself does not look alien. It looks distinctly humanoid. And that is suggestive, too, to me. And I don't think that they anticipated the development of the human race, because the old equator was probably not the equator of Mars until at least 3.2 million years ago, the date of the most recent explosion, because there had to have been a pole shift, and the pole shift presumably had to have been caused by one of those explosion events. So 3.2 million years ago is, in my judgment, the youngest that Cydonia could be. But 3.2 million years ago happens to be a very interesting date with respect to the Earth, because that is the Pleistocene boundary on Earth, when the whole Earth climate changed from tropical to intermittent ice ages. And something else even more significant to us happened at that epoch. What is it? The origin of the hominid species, the oldest hominid fossils, date from 3 million years ago on this planet. So this made me wonder. Suppose that we take the conclusion that the face on Mars is artificial. It was built by someone. It was built by someone intelligent, someone spacefaring, because it was intended to be viewed only from above or from space. It was probably built, maybe it was built by interstellar travelers, but probably built by the parent race on Planet V. But they would have faced a tremendous dilemma when they knew that their home planet was going to explode. They would have probably had to transplant their civilization, try to save as many as they could. You could get temporary shelter by going to the far side of Mars, but only temporary, because Mars was much too blasted by the explosion and lost most of its atmosphere. Ultimately, if you're going to have any long-term survival for your race, you would be faced with an interplanetary journey and relocating elsewhere. And clearly the most nearly suitable possibility was Earth. So, given merely the artificiality of the face, it seems to follow there were builders, they were someone, they were there up to at perhaps 3.2 million years ago, and faced with a survival dilemma, and they probably logically would have gone to Earth to relocate. Now, they themselves were doomed, because they surely wouldn't have been able to breathe our atmosphere and adapt to our biosystem. But with their knowledge, presumably superior to ours, they might not have had too much difficulty genetically engineering their own DNA with the most suitable species already here, the primates, to produce offspring that were adapted to this environment and could survive. Lacking a lot of their brain power and knowledge base at first, and more concerned with survival than with continuing a high technology civilization, there might have followed a period of dark ages, but perhaps there is an actual genetic link between them and us. The explosion was apparently accompanied by a huge water dump on Mars, and we wonder if that might have led to the legends about the 65 million year ago loss of the home planet. Might be the Garden of Eden, Eden legend origin, and the water dump at 3.2 million years ago might have been the origin of the flood legend. What's for sure is that if you did plan such an interplanetary journey, you would do your best to take two of every kind of animal and samples of all the plant and food products that you needed to survive and try to transplant them to the new world. This is a logical deduction for the situation that the Cydonia builders must have been faced with at one point in their history. And these are so similar to legends in our history here on Earth that it really makes me wonder if there isn't a connection. The Garden of Eden, Noah's Ark, all of the most ancient legends of the human race, are we perhaps finding scientific clues now that justify these things? Speculations, I repeat, but possibilities and interesting ones to think about. I'll conclude with the last musical selection.
Lit by green flashes, cylinder following cylinder, and no one and nothing was left now to fight them. The Earth belonged to the Martians.
My conclusion then is that perhaps the scenario of War of the Worlds is true in a sense, but with the twist that we're the Martians. Thank you very much.
On this a priori, a posteri, sounds like two Italian brothers running a diner on the south side. Because to me, there's a very intriguing philosophical trap buried in that, all right? It is a bit like a lawyer. Because if you walk up on a totally alien world and you have no idea what to expect, you have made no predictions, and you find something, how do you ever make a decision? You're stuck. Captain Kirk would never be in that position. He was beaming down to alien civilizations all over the place. Now, how did he know that what he found was artificial? Because obviously you can't predict for a whole galaxy, let alone a whole solar system. So if it weren't... See, the face has been the trap. In Monuments, I clearly laid out that it was the best thing that had happened on this and the worst thing, because it fixated all of us into looking at things we know, when in fact the universe is filled with things we don't know. The history of science is figuring out what we don't know. And this whole mechanism of how you develop a predictive model and then look for the next data point. I mean, I could do something really cute like say, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what's the next number? Of course not, it's 9. I did a change-up, because an intelligent person doesn't have to follow the pattern. If you're looking at intelligence, by definition, it's going to be unpredictable. The human species, as a gestalt, if you look at cultures, they do the most unpredictable things, but they're intelligent. So our definitions and our model has got to expand beyond the rigid legalisms that you have laid down. Not to say that you haven't created a good foundation. Not to say that it hasn't worked for you. but it's not the only road to Rome. That's what I was saying before. What I find interesting is that here I'm standing next to Tom Van Flandern, who is now basically saying that Noah's Ark came from Mars. I have a fundamentalist radio guy who would like to talk to you, okay? named Bill Brumbaugh, who would love to get you on his show. Boy, that audience is going to have a field day. But we've arrived at this place by two totally separate routes, and neither one is correct or incorrect. They're different. It's my dear friend Gene Roddenberry, Giddick, infinite diversity, infinite combination. The universe is not only, as Haldane said, more squirrely than we imagine, it's squirrelier than we can imagine. But the essence of science is to try to put the order a posteriori in the squirreliness, because we can't imagine all possibilities. If it was, we'd be into ESP and psychokinesis and imprinting the universe, and we would never need to learn anything. This 3D experience is a learning experience in terms of placing coherence to patterns we perceive. And somewhere in this discussion, we're going to come to a meeting of the minds. Or we're going to kill each other. I mean, it's that simple. Now, the other thing that I wanted to ask had to do with the pole shifts. A cornerstone, an a priori prediction now of our model, is that Olympus Mons has to be, because of the upwelling and the planetary physics and all that, it's got to be at 19.5. I don't care where you put the pole, if Olympus Mons does not stay at 19.5, Houston, we got a problem. So in that computer, do you have the equation for figuring the pole position? And across lunch, can you tell me if when you move the pole, does Olympus Mons, with this stuff at the equator, stay at 19.5? That's a key prediction of our model.
Well, I don't think it needs to, Dick, because Olympus Mons didn't exist before the planetary explosion. Therefore, it doesn't matter where that place on Mars would have been before the explosion. But once the explosion happened and you piled 20 kilometers thickness of debris on one half of Mars, you squeezed Mars, which caused this tremendous pressure at the equator, and it caused the volcanic outbursts at the release point. So somewhere in the general equatorial regions, and I'll accept 19.5 for the sake of argument, that had to be the new 19.5, not the original 19.5.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand it, you're saying that Olympus Mons is a direct artifact of Mars being too close to Planet 5 when it blew up.
That's right.
Okay. In our model, Olympus Mons is as big and where it is because it was part of the indigenous planetary process from the beginning, for billions of years. These points where energy comes up, where lava on lithospheric planets comes up. On Earth, it's Hawaii. Now, Hawaii, as you know, because of plate tectonics, moves. And you can see this string of archipelagos which run backward. But the actual upwelling point is always at 19.5. You're moving the paper across the cigarette, all right? On Venus, you have Alta and Beta Regio. On the Moon, you have Tsiolkovsky on the far side, which is 19.5, the only dark floored crater on the back, which has an upwelling of lavas. This is an interesting way to see how this process works, because, yes, in our model, there was an explosion concurrent with Tom's. But before there was an explosion, there was a moon, a planet-sized moon orbiting this other body. It was spinning. That spinning process creates the physics that produces upwellings, energy inside, upwellings that have to come up according to this geometry. They're not random. If you look at Io, at Europa, at Jupiter, there's a stunning pattern now, incredible pattern conforming to these upwellings along this sacred hyperdimensional geometry. So we're looking at two effects: indigenous planetary processes that are hyperdimensional plus the effects of the explosion. You're attributing Olympus Mons randomly to the explosion. Our model says there had to be a big upwelling prior to the explosion, and it had to live at 19.5. That's where in the solar system all the big major upwellings exist. On Venus, which suffered some remarkable catastrophe, Maxwell Montes is that original 19.5 upwelling. Venus now is sitting straight up and down. It didn't used to. It had a nice little tilt, and the tilt is not planet tipping inertially relative to stars. The tilt is internal, because you have to move the coordinate point from some random location to where it is now. So we're, this is a very non-trivial point. The other point is that where Cydonia lives now, at 41 in round numbers north, and its orientation, which is 22.5 degrees as measured by Mert Davies, west of due north, which is what I said in the book, is implicit in the hyperdimensional artificial model. That was a prediction. That was an a priori prediction. All right. The problem is that the latitude is not random. If it starts out on the equator, like Tom says, and it now is at 41 degrees, 40.868, geodetic latitude, that latitude is not a random latitude. Now, how if you hit a moon and it goes careening off into its own orbit, initially trapped around another moon, right, the ice moon, how does it wind up giving you two specific, mathematically significant latitudes by random chance? And the answer is it can't. So there's other forces and factors at work here. But this is a very fruitful area to pursue. And what I'm wondering is, if it starts out at the equator, as you very elegantly have laid out now, does Olympus Mons still wind up at 19.5? And I would be willing to bet there is a solution within what's-his-name's pole drift model.
Schultz.
Which you haven't thought of because you didn't think it was important. You didn't know it was really important. And I'm just wondering if over lunch, somewhere in there, there's a way you can do the spherical trig, you know, and tell us after lunch if Olympus Mons, when Cydonia was at the equator and everything was lined up north and south, was Olympus Mons still at 19.5? Because if that turns out to be true, you've got a convert on some stuff here, okay? Say again? Well, but you can't make it go away. In other words, one of the things about Mars that is very different than the Earth is because the crust is so thick, the lithosphere is so thick, you don't have the movements of the plates like you do here. So the whole side of Mars on which Olympus Mons is perched is bulged out. And this was, prior to Tom's analysis, a really interesting problem that came up from the Mariner 4 data, the Mariner 6 and 7 data, the Mariner 9 data. The more data we've had from flying spacecraft to Mars over the last 30 years, the more this lopsided Mars really bothered a lot of people, and there is no mainstream solution. There really isn't. There's a lot of arm-waving, but there is no reason why Mars should bulge out on that side. In the hyperdimensional model, it's because you have a rigid lithosphere, and then you pile lava up, you keep pushing it up, and the physics itself has made a lopsided world, which is frozen in space and time because of the rigidity of the crust. In his model, it's been hit like the Chloris Basin on Mercury from one side, and then you've got this stuff on the other side that kind of juts out and then freezes in place. Is that a fair approximation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're not mutually exclusive. They could be additive. All right, but to be additive, Olympus Mons has got to be the big volcano. There is a big thing on each of these worlds we've looked at in the solar system, because the primary upwelling is at 19.5, and it's not 19.5 in a ring, it's 119.5. It has to do with vortices coalescing and deciding to live at one place. On Earth, before the impact of the asteroids 65 million years ago, the upwelling was under the deck and shield traps. It moved. It's like if you ever put a tea kettle on the stove, and you begin to hear it boil, and then you hit it, and momentarily it stops boiling. The cavitation bubbles momentarily stop. Well, if you hit a planet from outside with a big force, the upwellings in the hyperdimensional model, which create the vortices, will migrate to the next tetrahedral point. They will then recoalesce. That's what happened in our model between 65 million and the present. They drifted by one vertex over. So now they're at Hawaii, as opposed to the Deccan Shield position, which was 60 degrees to the east, to the west, I'm sorry. Or is it 120? I think it's 60, okay. The point being that in this model, Olympus Mons is the single biggest upwelling. It always was at 19.5, and this solution, this little spherical trig solution, has to come up with that and Cydonia and the face at the equator. If it only if the model, well, a model is a predictive, you know. Well, it would disprove one of our models. And thereby hangs the test. What I was saying last night, there's lots of neat ideas out there, but what I'm trying to lay out is there's a mechanism, there's a process. We're certainly in sync on this for figuring out which neat ideas are correct and which are almost correct. And this is not horseshoes. It's not close but no cigar. This is a really defining test. No, I said the structures. No, it's always relative to the spin axis, all right? No, I didn't say that, no. No, what I said was that in the same coordinate frame of the pole where it is now, it can migrate east and west, depending upon what external impacts or external forces hit the planet. Because the actual lava coming up is determined by the whirlpool in the liquid mantle, liquid core, outer core, far below the mantle. What happens is, in the models, these things are coming. Ever seen that Prel commercial where they drop the Prel, they drop the pearl in the Prel and it sinks slowly? All right, well, the inverse of what's going on is you have these hot spots, which are not understood in current geophysics, and there's lava apparently coming up from very deep down, 1,800 miles from the outer core, up through the mantle, erupting on the crust. They're like the pearl in, if you ran the videotape in reverse, they're like the pearl floating up from the bottom of the Prel bottle. And they float because they're warmer, and therefore they're buoyant, and they're like hot air balloons. Huge volumes, hundreds and hundreds of cubic miles of hot lava coming up 1,800 miles and erupting on the surface. There's a vortex under that eruption. That vortex is like the great red spot on Jupiter. In the model, in the fluids, it has to live as a vortex at 19.5 in the rotating coordinate frame of the planet. You rotate that planet in space, that vortex rotates with it. If you rotate the crust around the planet and the core vortex stays the same, it will erupt at a new position. We don't see in the solar system a lot of big stuff. We see one big thing at 19.5, except for Venus, where it's not. It's up at 60 now. And on Earth, according to Tom, Mars, according to Tom, the biggest thing, Olympus Mons, just happens to be where it is now because of a catastrophic event, a random event. We're saying, no, it's an extremely coherent process, and that's the defining test between the two models. Well, if Venus, the pole position doesn't correspond to Maxwell Montes being at 19.5. On Mars, the pole position corresponds exactly to Olympus Mons being at 19.5. In other words, on Venus, the pole position has shifted. In this physical model, the position is not where it used to be on Venus. But Venus is weird for a whole bunch of other really neat reasons, and we've never really gone into Venus. That's a whole other seminar, all right? But on Mars, what Tom would be saying is that just by accident, the largest impact and the largest resulting effect, which is Olympus Mons, happens to be at 19.5. We have a pattern over the rest of the solar system where the biggest stuff is 19.5. I'm saying it's not an accident. It's part of a physics pattern. And if that pattern is to serve us, it serves us for Mars. And that means that if the space in Cydonia were ever at the equator, as he is proposing, it has to be anchored with Olympus Mons still being at 19.5 when you change the position in some meridian.
That's a good point.
Olympus Mons is at 25 kilometer elevation above the mean datum, I believe.
But the other three Tarsus volcanoes aren't slouches.
No, they're on that ridge too. I mean, they're not that far away. All right, no, Arcia Mons and all that. That's an interesting point. All right, that's a possibility. But that would mean that you're not far off. In other words, one of the others was the primary. But they're all within a relatively small geographic region. What, 500 miles, something like that?
Something like
yeah.
that.
Anyway, the reason I'm making a point about this is that we're talking about neat ideas that are beyond the edge of most people's paper. There still is a means to test them. And those tests should be carefully applied.
And I would add that if you made a specific prediction with almost no chance to come true by chance, and yet it came true, that is, if you made the prediction a priori, and the fulfillment of that would be persuasive to me and many other scientists, whereas having another model in reserve if one is falsified, the way all of the mainstream astronomers do with all of their models, is ultimately unpersuasive.
Now,
in other words, don't have... your remark before about that would falsify one of your models. Find something, not necessarily that, but find some prediction you can make that has almost no reasonable chance to happen by accident. Make that prediction and put your models at risk, and the degree to which an improbable or unaccepted model is put at risk by the predictions it makes it corresponds to the degree of persuasiveness it has when those predictions come true, if they do.
He is a lawyer. Since when did risk enter into science?
Well, risk has been taken out of science, but it's supposed to be there. You put your model forward and let the observations and experiments decide.
I don't know. I'm having an interesting philosophical problem with this because it has nothing to do with what's at stake. It has to do with how do you figure out what's right or wrong, and it doesn't depend on whether someone is right or wrong. That's irrelevant in the process. It's how do you walk up on a totally unknown environment and figure anything out if you're supposed to predict it all before you get there. You can't do it. It's impossible. Therefore, we'll never figure anything out. Now, that's philosophically an impossible position, Tom. That doesn't work. There's something wrong with this picture. All right? I mean, we have got such extraordinary data now extending out through Wilson's data to nearby stars that 19.5 is a key eruption point, that I would be willing to, quote, risk, what that means, a lot on the idea that Olympus Mons has to be the upwelling point, the original primordial upwelling point. If Cydonia, in his view, at the equator, doesn't match, in other words, you have two data points, and you swing the arc so that both of them fit, it could easily turn out to be further confirmation of his model. It would be really neat if it turns out. And I can't do it in my head. I don't know where the positions are, so he's working the problem.
No.
Oh, no, we're not? Oh, okay. Anyway, it's...
Do you have the coordinates of Olympus Mons?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Loser buys. Now, there's a practical person. To hell with all this airy-fairy stuff.
In that case, I want specifics. How close does it come?
Welcome Richard Hoagland back to the podium for him to present some stunning video footage for you and to get us primed for Lieutenant Colonel Bearden. And as soon as Richard is finished, then I will introduce him as well. Okay.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I see you all survived lunch. Oh, and do this. What I want to do is to kind of come off some of the things that Tom had done, which is to provide a slight bit of continuity. A friend of mine wrote a book recently. His name is Graham Hancock, and the name of the book is The Mars Mystery: The Secret Connection Between Earth and the Red Planet. And the secret connection, of course, is becoming less and less secret all the time. We're looking at now a kind of a complete scenario. We know now that we have ruins on Mars. Any reasonable person looking at the litany of a priori tests, which Dr. Van Flandern has subjected this data to, together with the work of Enterprise and the work of other independent researchers and what's available on the web in great detail, has to come to the reasonable conclusion that there are ruins on the planet Mars. If you at this point don't believe there are ruins, then you certainly don't belong in this auditorium and you have not been paying close attention, because inherently there is nothing surprising, oddly enough, that there are ruins on Mars. If you take the Sagan criteria from the summer of 1996, if you take the Sagan criteria, which he laid down a priori before Viking went to Mars, and I'll paraphrase, what Carl said was that if we found as much as a microbe independently evolved on another planet in this solar system, then implicitly it meant the galaxy was teeming with life. You put that statement together with the announcement by Dan Golden and company in August of 96 of the little microbes in the rock, ALH8001, Alan Hills 001, and regardless of where that rock came from, it doesn't have to come from Mars. Can come from, you know, Planet 5 or from outside the solar system. It's irrelevant where it came from. The only criteria is it shouldn't come from Earth. If you can establish with the isotopes that it didn't come from Earth, which is what they've done, there's no doubt that rock did not come from Earth. There is no doubt that the material in it is not contamination from Earth. The reason? The stuff gets more interesting as you get in toward the core. Hard to imagine a model of contamination where the good stuff is inside and the surface is not contaminated. It has to come from the outside to the inside, unless it beamed in, Scotty, which it didn't do. So, a priori, we now have very good evidence that there was microbial life on some other body in this solar system. Doesn't matter which one. Take your pick. Make up one. I mean, Tom's making up planets out there. You can join the fun, all right? The point is that that instantly fulfills the Sagan criteria. And if that criteria is fulfilled, it means that the galaxy, the Milky Way alone of 400 billion other stars, is teeming with life. Now, that brings us to Tom Bearden and Dick Hoagland, because what we are separately saying is that there is a physics, an extraordinary... I almost had to smile when Tom was saying that the reason that they built the Cydonia theme park is because it took a year to get to Earth. I mean, Tom is still operating with Newton's third law, which is what good celestial mechanics has to do. If we live in a world, in a universe of variable gravity and variable C and variable other constants, and the ability to, with time-reversed waves, literally restructure biology and put in stasis the aging process itself, then just maybe there is a way to come up with warp drive. I mean, do I have to put that video up there over Mexico City one more time to show that you don't need rockets, boys and girls? I'm going to show you something else in a little while, which is even, if you can imagine, even more extraordinary. The point is that constraining our Mars model now within the NASA program, within the textbook view of physics, is silly. Because we already know that we have learned too much to ever go back to where we were. We know now that we can control gravity. You've seen it done. Unless that film is an outright fake. And how would we test if it's a fake? Simple. You could obviously do that on a computer. But you couldn't make up all the Mexican witnesses who went on Jaime's show and who blabbed and blabbed and blabbed and were absolutely agog at what they had seen. Unless you really go in for conspiracy and say that each one of those people was carefully bought. And at some point, that breaks down. So using Occam's razor, it's simpler to believe that this extraordinary electric vehicle was hovering over 19.5 degrees. And I keep mentioning that number. That number is non-random. That is part of an a priori prediction. If somebody is trying to tell you about the physics in a non-interference way, at the level of Jean's prime directive, then maybe they'll hang out at 19.5 and hope you get the connection between that latitude on a rotating planet and how you build a vehicle that can go anywhere in the solar system or beyond with ease. So we're not limited to rockets. We're not limited to some kind of primitive, archaic Chinese technology given to us by Wan Ho. He's the guy that supposedly invented the rocket. If there is a connection between Earth and Mars, and I do have, here it is, then the connection is going to be found in the mythologies. And so one of the things that we began doing was looking at some of these ancient cultures to see if, in fact, such connections could be found. And I wrote a whole section of monuments called The Terrestrial Connection, which of course is what Graham took this title, from with Light Changes, because he is, he and I have had long conversations, and he has well known that we have been looking in these directions for many, many years. Well, we have come up with some pretty interesting connections. So let me start with the most obvious, which is, why is there a face on Mars at all? All right, if I can have the video now. I want the first video. What I'm going to show you is a piece of work by Kinthea, who is the Enterprise mission art director. She has, for about 15 years now, worked with us and has been helping by sculpting various aspects of Zenonia, and she has worked long and hard on the face itself. Now, what they're doing here is they're matching the lighting between the two sun angles in the finished sculpture.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's go ahead and do it again. I'm going to change the settings. I did it at 1/60th of a second. Now, I'm going to do it at 1/125th. Let's see what happens now. Okay? So, go ahead and start whenever you wish.
Ready.
Okay, go ahead and go.
Now, this is sunrise, mimicking sunrise. Sun comes up over in the east over here.
Okay. And let's do it at 1/350th of a second.
Okay.
Not that it's going to... Anyway, so go ahead and go anytime you wish.
Okay, going.
Was, if you're looking for rationales, if you're looking at a huge statue, the statue has a reason to exist. In 88, when we realized that the right-hand side appeared to be more Leonid than human, and that this matched the Leonid, anthropoid, or hominid sphinx at Giza, linked by that geometry, there was a very clear concept, a prediction, that this had to be implicit in the model on Mars for a reason. What was the reason? The reason is to communicate, to tell us something. What is it supposed to tell us? Well, the prediction in Monuments, which was written in 83 and actually finished in 87, before we had the Leonid data, was that potentially the face on Mars existed to demonstrate evolution during the course of the Martian day. Sun rising in the east, crossing the meridian at noon, setting in the west at sunset. And the idea that if you were very sophisticated and you made a kind of a living statue, it would evolve, it would change characteristics, physiognomy, as the lighting during the day changed. And what Kinthea has now been able to demonstrate with a physical hands model using the latest data from both Viking and the Surveyor imagery is in fact that that evolutionary progressive change occurs. Now, I had asked Tom and Carlotto and others to do this in the computer, but they've not gotten around to it yet. So I had Kinthea simply do it, you know, with a model. And she has sculpted this thing now literally probably 100 times. So she's getting very good at it. And in fact, part of this was used in the UPN broadcast when UPN came out to Enterprise in New Mexico. They spent a whole day during the time that the photographs were coming in, and they incorporated some of this footage in their coverage. That is pretty interesting evidence in support of an evolutionary reason. Somebody wanted somebody else to see this from dawn to dusk as an evolutionary history of some physical creature in the solar system. Yes. No. We have actually only used the Sidonia latitude. It wouldn't change that much because, you know, it's eastern lighting. It would still work. I mean, that does not really... No, that would not affect that, all right? The whole point is this idea of a connection between worlds, of a connection to this world and Mars, is endemic in the model at this point. Now, who better would have a reason to memorialize a connection, particularly a connection back in time, an evolutionary connection, than possibly the people who built the place themselves? In other words, from our point of view, the converging evidence is that, as Tom ended his presentation, yes, we are the Martians. And we just forgot. We have been incredibly traumatized. It's almost like there's a cultural amnesia. There are people that I meet who can't even begin to confront these ideas because they are painful to them. There is a very important psychological phenomenon known as, it's called pain avoidance, or it's called traumatic amnesia, where something so incredibly horrendous has happened that you literally can't remember. There's like a blank in your life, right? Now, can that apply to species? Can that apply to a racial memory? Can that apply to whole cultures? Is there a part of us which somehow remembers our ancestry and what has happened to it so that we, as its great-great-great-great descendants, can't remember? Or is the reincarnative model true? Do we just keep coming back and forgetting big things in our lives that are too painful to remember, and that's why we act weirdly? You know, I mean, there's a whole database that says that the way to remove psychological problems in this life is to go and fix them in some previous life. I am completely neutral. I do not know. But I do know that there is an interesting set of possibilities for finding out, for testing these ideas, for pursuing the implications. Because if the human race is screwed up because of something that happened, you know, 3.2 million years ago or 65 million years ago, frankly, I'd like to get out of it and get on with it. And there's a lot of other deeper implications. This is not trivial. Someone asked me the other day, well, why do people keep coming and going from Enterprise? Why, you know, I have a whole book where I acknowledge a whole bunch of people, and a lot of those people are no longer with the project. And I said, it's very natural. They stayed with it up until it got real, and then they split. We have a very interesting phenomenon in this culture where we will play all kinds of head games with UFOs and aliens and all that. When you come up Denny or First Street and make the turn, there's this alien exhibit at the Pacific Science Center right next door right now. And they have all these little cute billboards, you know, like hurry and see it before it's covered up, you know, or get there before the mothership. And I mean, it's all light and fun and bouncy. And I'm thinking to myself, do these people who put this exhibit on have any idea of what this really means, if it's true, which it is? No, of course not. They're playing a head game. So people come to Enterprise, they come to this research, and at the point where suddenly, oh my God, they turn into Valley Girls. No, where it suddenly becomes real. I mean, I can give you a list of people who have warped out at Warp 9. Because they can't handle it. Remember that great line by Jack Nicholson? You can't handle the truth. That's our problem. We're living in a culture which has been conditioned so it cannot handle the truth. Now, has the conditioning been from the outside or is it from the inside? I think it's a bit of both. And yet there are people, there's a lot of them in this room, who can't. It's like water in a desert. They have to know the truth. They have to be here on a sunny Seattle Sunday afternoon. And so you can see what it looks like. All right. If we track the connections to Earth, then obviously if there's a signal there, we're going to find it in some ancient cosmology or philosophy or set of myths or legends or history. So, as we began to pursue this terrestrial connection, what Graham calls the Mars connection, pretty soon it became obvious that we should focus on Egypt. It is the most remarkable surviving template of something that is so ineffable that refracted through the lens of thousands of years, it still awes people who go there. It's not cerebral. It's not. It even touches you when you're not there. And people say to me, "You've never been to Egypt?" No. But how can you know some things? It's because it has more dimensions than just the linear, just the metonymic. Not the least of which is, as you start looking at these myths and you start looking at the relationships, you find. And let me diminish this and show you something that Graham found, which I put into somewhat of a coherent format. And I think it's here. What he did in the Mars connection was to tabulate a number of the things that we had identified in monuments and added a couple. And the couple that he added are so strikingly intriguing. Right. Evidence of a connection between Mars and Earth can actually be summarized in a series of bullets. The tangent of the latitude of the Sphinx and pyramids on Mars is identical to the cosine of the Sphinx and pyramids of Egypt. And for those who like odds, the odds against this, to the accuracy we have measured it now, is about 7,000 to 1. The Great Sphinx of Egypt is a feline hominid composite. It's a man-lion image carved in limestone. The Martian Sphinx, the face on Mars, is also a man-lion composite. The left half is hominid, the right half is feline, and oh yes, there is an ancient Egyptian, rather Hindu myth, that portrays the planet Mars, as I said yesterday, as Nir-Samha, which is the man-lion. And the Vedic traditions are even earlier, we have now discovered, than the Egyptians. The signal seems to be purer in the Far East, in the Vedic. All right, for much of its history, we know the Sphinx was painted red. We also know that to the ancient Egyptians, it was called Hor-Dashur, Horus the Red, Horus being the official designation of the pharaoh, the son of Osiris, which is Orion, by way of the Egyptian goddess Isis, which is Sirius, the brightest, most important star in the Egyptian cosmology. Now, in the earlier Egyptian designation, Horus the Elder, was Heru. And according to Sir Wallace Budge, and I put this in Monuments, the original translation of Heru, of Horus, was a face. Finally, they found inscriptions in some of the northern sites that designates Mars as his name is Horakati, the eastern star. The gaze of the Sphinx, of course, is due east, directly toward sometimes the rising of Mars, in particular at midnight on December 31 of this year. And the Sphinx's name is also Horakati. In other words, to the ancient Egyptians, the Sphinx was identical with Mars. And the ancient Egyptian term for the Sphinx, in addition to Horakati, was Arkur, which means the end of the beginning and the beginning of the end, in a cycle, in a circle. Remember that song? Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, always turning, never ending, like an ever-spinning wheel. The physics that we have discerned is the physics of cycles. The cycles imprint themselves on planets, on stars, and I now am firmly coming to believe on cultures, on the rise and fall of cultures. And the only cultures we have to look at are human cultures. But there's strong suspicion in my mind that the other of the cultures are equally important, particularly if they extend to Mars, if they extend to another planet over, where we are descendant from. If that is true, if we literally are somehow the descendants of immigrants, of refugees from Mars, then it stands to reason that at the point of contact, at the point where the first footfall of those refugees made landfall on this planet, some extraordinary monument would memorialize that great transition. The only argument is when. Tom has one figure. He says 3.2 million. I think it was a lot more recent. I think it's around 200,000. The reason I say 200,000 is because we have very strong evidence from several different lines, starting with the actual Giza location itself and the orientation of the complex, the architectural complex, that the plateau is literally oriented due north-south, but not now, but as it was almost a quarter of a million years ago. The pyramid and everything is offset by about 5 arc minutes. If you plug into the plate tectonic model, which is measured by quasar calibration and now GPS calibration, the actual plate of Africa is rotating slowly and drifting to the southwest. If you unwind the numbers, when the plateau and the pyramids were all lined up due north, stemming from a paper in 1973 in Science, was 189,000 years ago. Now that is so much more ancient, so much more incredible than anybody would give credence to in terms of the current, you know, pyramid building epic of 2400, 2500 BC, that when the guys who wrote the paper came up with this number, they just threw it out. They were trying to use plate tectonics to calibrate the Khufu date, and when it didn't work, they stopped thinking. They didn't say, wait a minute. What we have discovered, and it was John West who first put me onto this, he told me that the blocks around the Khefren pyramid, the middle pyramid, going down to the Sphinx, are huge, big, and appear to be much older than the Khefren pyramid. And there was a light that went on, and I said, aha! We're not talking structures, we're talking site plan. The site plan itself was laid out, I'd be willing to bet dollars to Old Navy beans, about a quarter of a million years ago. That also happens to be the date when the moon began to move. A completely separate calculation. We know that there's an ideal distance in this physics for Earth's moon. I don't have time to develop that this afternoon, but in future publications and in the new book, that will come out. Since the Apollo astronauts went to the moon and put those little laser reflectors on the moon's surface, we've been able to bounce laser beams off the surface of the moon and gauge to within an inch or two accuracy over 30 years now the rotations, the revolutions, and the increasing spiraling out of the moon. The moon is moving away from the Earth at about an eighth of an inch a year. If you reel the clock back to the ideal hyperdimensional distance, and there is one in the model, it turns out that at time zero, when the moon was at that ideal distance, is exactly the same time frame, plus or take, give or take 10,000 years, as the site plan laid out on Giza 200,000 years ago. So you begin to put all these... Oh, there's one other piece of evidence. The moons of Mars are also drifting. Phobos, the inner moon, is spiraling in, and into the next between 10 and 40 million years, the projections are that it is going to drop dead. It's going to literally crash into Mars and be history and take a lot of Mars with it. It's a potato-shaped piece of rock about 15, 20 miles across. It's incredibly weird that the human species should arrive. We're back to this a priori statistics business. In the last 0.1% of the lifetime of a moon of the solar system. I mean, it's like you're almost present at the death of something that's lasted billions and billions of years. What are the odds that we'll all arrive here in time to almost witness the death of Phobos? Well, the answer is we shouldn't. But maybe there's some relationship between us being here and Phobos dying. And that relationship is that when all this junk happened to Mars, and the satellites were emplaced in orbit, the little guys that we currently see, when they stopped being maintained in orbit by this incredibly sophisticated hyperdimensional civilization, and they began to drift, particularly Phobos, as it spirals in, we can now take Russian data, Viking data, and ground-based Lowell Observatory data, and we can get a very accurate gauge of how fast Phobos has been spiraling in. We can then unwind the clock and put it back at its ideal hyperdimensional tetrahedral distance, because the moons of Mars are not just arbitrarily running around. Errol Torin, not me, but Errol Torin, our friend at Defense Mapping, first found this out and did the calculation. And he called me on the phone 10 years ago one day, and he says, "Dick, you're not going to believe what I found." I said, "Oh, yes, I am. Tell me." He said, 200,000 years, plus or minus 10,000. Now, you got all these separate data points converging on the same date. Oh, we got a fourth one, all right? It's called the search for Eve. How many here know about the mitochondrial search for DNA and the legacy of Homo sapiens and basically the female side of the line? Well, the genetic work has now revealed that instead of being lineally connected with, you know, Australopithecus and Homo erectus and all that, guys millions of years back in the fossil record, we somehow genetically started yesterday. And that doesn't square at all with the fossil evidence. Well, what's the resolution? Well, it's so obvious to us, and so they're so oblivious in the mainstream because they'll never figure it out. They are trapped within their model. If you are determined to say that human beings evolved on this planet, you'll never figure out the way out of the box, out of the anomaly. Obviously, the mitochondrial date is the date of genetic outside tinkering. Or, extending the model, of genetic outside migration, of the mass exodus from one place to planet Earth of a whole other species, separate genetically from Australopithecus and Neanderthal and Homo erectus et al. Anybody want to guess the date of Eve from the mitochondrial DNA? 200,000 years. Now, the mainstream guys have their antenna are vibrating, and they realize this is a deadly date, so they have mounted a tremendous assault to knock down Wilson and the other guys who have been working on this and try to show that it doesn't match and the rates are not calculable and it's not really science. It's not going to work. So we have four separate lines of evidence all converging on that date. Something remarkable and exquisite happened at 200,000 years. Oh, and there's another one that nobody is going to believe, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Anybody here ever hear of a gal named Helena Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy? Helen Blavatsky, you know, Isis Unveiled, etc. Back in the 1900s, before things got cooked, when the system was still honest, you know, when Maxwell was doing his thing before he got sabotaged, Blavatsky apparently wrote some stuff in London, founder of the Theosophical Society, and out of their material, there is a date, remember, 100 years ago, for the transition of intelligent beings to Earth from the planet Mars. Would you like to guess the Blavatsky date? 200,000 years. Now that one, you know, it's a little iffy, I admit. But now we got five separate dates, five separate modalities, five separate techniques, all giving us roughly the same date. So I'm willing to say that the transition, the final transition, was probably that close to us in time. But that's telling us something extraordinary. It means that something survived Mars and hung on from 3.2 million the time of Tom's catastrophe to 200,000. In other words, what's so dangerous about this game, and why I have resisted for years, for decades, literally, getting into what I call the soap opera, is because intelligent histories are by definition totally unpredictable a priori. Human beings alone are too unpredictable. I mean, would you ever imagine a culture like China simultaneous with us? I mean, think about it. On the same planet, within a few thousand miles, two radically different philosophies. Parkinson called it East and West. Well, that's just on one small planet. Imagine on two worlds in the same solar system, or two star systems in the same spiral arm of the galaxy. There's no way to predict what you're going to find. You just got to go find it. Then you have to have a logical process to decide within what you found what the next data points are and make your predictions once you're on site, once you're on the ground. So, I don't have a lot of time, and I want to kind of make a set of connections here with where this is going. If we are looking at ourselves as a transplanted alien species, kind of strangers in a strange land, you all wonder what Robert Heinlein was really doing, right? Now you know. Go back and read that book. Robert knew. I don't know how he knew, but Robert knew. Then there are certain concomitant implications. One of the implications is that there will be a small subgroup, a priesthood, a dedicated priesthood who will have been tasked, who will have tasked themselves with preserving this essential, crucial knowledge. Because what is more holy and sacred than the knowledge of your true origins? Particularly if you bring in transcendent or metaphysical or religious concepts as huge catastrophes, biblical size catastrophes, probably would be wont to do. And all we have to do is look at the Egyptian metaphors and see stunning examples of these enormous mythologies. For instance, certain of the Egyptian myths that Alan All, what's his name? The Phoenix Solution book. Alan Alford. I don't remember his last name. It's a damn good book. He is connecting it with, of course, Tom's work and making a very good stab at demonstrating that, in fact, it should be, it should be possible to identify now some of the key, All right. I'll find it. There it is. some of the key ancient Egyptian cosmological concepts with the concept of an exploded planet. All right? Let me show you where this shows up in the most surprising way. All right? This is a panorama taken from Apollo 11, July 20th, 1969, looking east. It's about a 120-degree field of view. All right, I'll pop it up full screen here. And again, I will not have time to document all of this afternoon, but it'll be enough that you can get a flavor. All right, I needed to do that there. Okay. You're looking toward the sun. All right, the sun is up over here. I've done a graphic. All right, there's the sun glints on the camera, and all Armstrong did is basically take a picture. Picture, picture, like making any panorama. The camera was on the chest of the spacesuit, all right? What we did, for reasons which are too complicated to go into this afternoon, was to basically take the same picture and we superimposed from the computer what the star field would be if they could have seen the stars against the glare of the sun on the airless moon. All right, and this is what the star field looks like. Okay, this is all the sky you would have seen if you had some kind of telescope or night vision or whatever against this glaring bright landscape. And there's the sun, all right, above the horizon, about 11 degrees. And over on the far right, right over here, is the bright star Sirius. Now remember, Sirius is Isis. She is the central figure of the Egyptian cosmology. She is the great goddess. We had a question last night about the goddess and her role in all of this. All right? Let me show you a rather surprising discovery. Because it turns out that 33 minutes after landing on the moon, and that time, 33 minutes, is very important. Okay? There we are. Okay. Sirius was 19.5 degrees above the eastern horizon. And at the exact time that Sirius, Isis in the Egyptian tradition, was poised behind them, invisible to the naked eye. I mean, there's no way that this had any possible relationship to the mission at all. Neil and Buzz, Buzz in particular, did a little religious ceremony in the lunar module with wine and wafer and all that. Now, everybody thought it was to, you know, I think he's a Presbyterian. I have a feeling it was not Presbyterian. Now, how do I know that? Because he brought back from the moon, in his position as a 32nd degree Mason, a number of Masonic paraphernalia that he had taken to the moon in that lunar module to land at the Sea of Tranquility at this precise moment when Isis, which is the central heart of the Masonic religious tradition, was at 0.5 degrees behind him on the eastern lunar horizon. And we have photographs. In fact, I can show you, if I've got it in here, the actual photo of Aldrin bequeathing the flag to, here we are, something else that's very significant, which is the actual Apollo emblem, the patch under which we flew the Apollo missions to the moon, was nothing more or less, no, this is not less, than the encapsulation of Sirius Orion imagery of ancient Egyptian legend. Because there is Orion, which is Osiris, which is the consort of Isis, which in Alan Alford's book, in fact, is Isis. The Egyptians had this incredible art form of mixing and matching cosmological dualities. So different creatures and different entities and different gods come in different phases, and they all turn out to be different persona of the same concept, the same being, the same identity. So in essence, this is Isis. Now, she happens to be, in the traditional mythological unfolding, the mother of Horus and the consort of Osiris, but they're all linked. If you go and look at the classic Osiris legend, you'll see how inextricably they are linked. Well, lo and behold, while Isis is standing at 19.5 degrees above the eastern horizon on the moon, and I really should show you this because you're not going to believe me unless you see it, okay? So I have to show it to you. The Apollo 11 landing site at the exact same time as the Apollo 12 landing site at the exact same time as Apollo 11's landing on the moon. In other words, you're about 500 miles to the southwest of Apollo 11. You're in night. There's nobody there. There's not going to be anybody there until November of that year, 4 months later, 5 months later. And the only thing that's there is a little spiky tetrahedral thing called Surveyor 3, which, remember, the Apollo 12 astronauts are going to be vectored to land next to and clip off pieces and bring them home. At the exact same time that Isis at the 11 site is at 19.5 above the horizon, at the Apollo 12 site, which ostensibly hasn't even been picked yet, no one knows where Apollo 12 is going to land. If you stand there, Orion, Isis consort, is exactly bisected. The three belt stars are exactly bisected on the horizon, which is critical in the Egyptian mythology. Remember Horus of the horizon? The horizon represented the boundary between worlds, between dimensions, between this and the other side. And I'm not going to bore you with doing it, but if we were to go ahead in time to the night of the Apollo 12 landing with Bean and Conrad, at the time they landed, at the exact GMT time they landed, this middle star on Orion was exactly 19.5 degrees above the horizon at the Apollo 12 landing site. Now, this is not a coincidence. Absolutely, emphatically not. We had no way of predicting this pattern was going to be there, but once we found the pattern, every additional data point amplifies and is consistent with the ancient Egyptian pattern. And if one wants to take the time and read the stuff we put on the web, you will find this pattern extends through mission after mission after mission after mission, including Voyager 2, going out of the solar system now, was deliberately bent down over the north pole of Neptune, and it is headed for one star and one star alone, and guess which star that is? Sirius. Pioneer 10, the spacecraft that John Anderson is tracking, the first spacecraft to leave the solar system, is headed for one star after the Jovian encounter, and one star only, and guess which star that is? It is Aldebaran. It is the brightest star in the eye of Osiris's deathly antagonist Set in the mythology, in the Duat, in the constellations set against the nighttime Milky Way. And on and on and on. So I think we have identified where the core group, the preserver group, the sons of Horus, the ones whose job it was to preserve where we have come from and to somehow get us back to the garden, to use a Woodstock term, are hiding out. And they're hiding out in plain sight. Where of course they have to be hiding out. If you're looking at preservers whose job it is to get some remnant of their guys, the elite guys, the ones with the heritage, the ones who know what's going on, the ones charged with preserving, with reconstructing the first time, which is what this is in the Egyptian mythology, then of course you have to do it in the space program. Not going to hide it over in agriculture. So they're at the core of NASA. Surprise, surprise. And they just don't tell anybody. And when we figure it out and put it out there, they say, oh, they're crazy. They're out of their minds. I'm not an Egyptian priest. Yeah, really, Michael. And we have reverse speech some of these people, and boy, do they reveal things in reverse speech. I have time. I mean, I'm just giving you the highlights to show you why, and I need to go and check. All right, let's just have the next video, okay? This thing appears, and we can have sound, please. All right? when this thing appears over Mexico City, a wondrous, huge, lazily spinning, hyper-dimensional vehicle, physically going behind distant apartment houses, seen by multiple witnesses, a dozen or more witnesses, filmed in broad daylight above the most populated Western Hemisphere city in the world at 19.5. Do you wonder why I think maybe there is a connection to this larger meta pattern? And why I strongly suspect that this is our guys. In fact, I'm really, really hoping it's our guys, because we have some things that our guys need to do. Things that are coming up. Okay, we don't need to see the rest. We've already seen this a couple times. Let's stick in the STS-80, please. And I have absolutely new news, which I did not reveal on ART, about STS-80. Because now we leap from handheld video cameras looking at the sky from Earth at 19.5 to an official NASA shuttle mission, which flew in December of 1996. December 3rd, to be exact, is when this video was acquired. This was the mission, to refresh your memory, of Columbia, the mission where the astronauts were supposed to just let it run to bars, and there's no sound, so I'll just do the narration of the sound, all right? Yeah, just get to the first piece of video. Now, I cut this together for the Barwood dinner, so it's not the whole tape. It's basically an edited portion of the tape, all right? You're lazily flying at about 5 miles per second down across the South Pacific Ocean. You are approaching down here, all right, in the distance, Australia, and we've jumped ahead, all right? You're basically crossing a lot of empty ocean on this planet. It's the usual view from orbit. You're about 250 miles upstairs. You're flying in the space shuttle Columbia, and you are moving along, as I said, at about 5 miles per second. That's 18,000 miles per hour. It's important to give a piece of context and reference, because what we have now done is we have been able to, in the computer, actually put the dates and times and locations in and derive the stellar positions. And I have some things to say in a minute about that. This is now close-ups looking down from the bay cameras. There are four cameras in the payload bay that are run independently of what the crew is doing. The crew can be doing anything. They can be sleeping. They can be having lunch. They can be using tools, running experiments. And these cameras in the bay are basically manipulated by remote control from Houston, from a console in the Houston Control Center, in the MOCR, the Mission Operations Control Center. And they're run via satellite from the TDRS, the Tracking and Data Relay Satellite System, which uplinks data to and from a ground station in New Mexico from the TDRS satellites that are positioned at 22,300 miles above the equator. Now, all the data coming back from TDRS is encrypted. Even the Hubble data coming back through TDRS is encrypted, which is a whole other discussion that we're not going to follow, but that's interesting. This is late afternoon thunderstorms over Australia. All right, you can see the thunderheads towering. I mean, this is really, really amazing. You can see the Earth's horizon, the few miles of air that separates us from space, and the fragility of the environment and all that. I just wanted to give you a sense of place and a sense of feeling that we're looking at a balmy Pacific pastoral scene in orbit with no hint of what is coming. Now, this is a view, rotating the cameras in the bay, of the left wing and the Canadia arm here. This is from the camera mounted on the arm, all right, at the elbow, and the back of the shuttle, the so-called vertical stabilizer, or the tail. This is data across the top. It's day 337 of the mission, and there's other data up here that allows you to take the flight plans, which after a year and a half of attempting, we finally, a few weeks ago, that's the vertical stabilizer, these are the Ohm's pods that do the burns. This one's in shadow because the sunlight's coming in like that. This is an experiment in the payload bay. The camera that's going to be the focus is right at the back of the bay. Now, what they're going to do is a quick flip around of various cameras are going to actually go to three of the other cameras to show you views. Now, this one coming up is the one at the left of the bay, or I'm sorry, at the right. Here's the arm now. This is in the front of the cabin, looking back down toward the Ohms pods and the vertical tail here. There's another camera to our left. They're going to switch to that one in a second. All right? And we'll come up on that. And you'll see the parallax. You'll see that you've moved far to the left of the first camera. Okay? Now the arm is out over here. It says Canada on it. The camera we're going to be using for most of what we're going to see is located right back here, looking toward us. This is now the left camera behind the cockpit, looking toward the back. Then they go to bars. Then they flip to this black and white, low light level image intensifier camera. And that's the camera that's going to be used during the remainder of what we're going to be showing you. And you've got color bars here, and you've got black and white here for grayscale, and a grid. This is just a testing of the calibration of the camera. Then they turn it off, and they go to the camera itself, and it comes up, and it will oscillate in a minute here, because it has an AGC, automatic gain control, and it's hunting to find the right level, given the dimming illumination. You are now entering sunset. All right? The sun is going down, and the camera's electronics are trying to find the right gain level to give us a scene. And it now stabilizes right about here. Now you're looking, the two other cameras you looked at were here and here, and the one that's out here mounted on the elbow of the arm, okay? Now they're going to start panning the camera up. The Earth is up here. You're entering sunset. You're crossing the terminator from daylight to night at 250 miles, give or take, altitude, at 5 miles per second. And what you're going to see is a curved horizon here looking back towards sunset, toward the sun setting up out of frame. You can see this crescent, okay? Here's the crescent. And it's scattered light. It's like looking at any sunset except this one you're looking at 250 miles above the surface, and you're leaving it at that speed at 5 miles per second, so it's much, much faster than it is on the surface of the Earth. And what the camera's going to do, and I've stepped this through to basically collapse time, is looking at scattered light from the sun, which is hiding up here behind the Earth. And then as the light level gets lower and lower, the gain of the camera will get higher and higher, and then at some point you're going to be able to see stars down here in this portion of the frame. You'll see night over here, which is basically black, and you'll see a very thin layer of banded curved light, which is the Earth's atmosphere and the air glow layer. And the air glow is typically about 40 miles above the surface of the planet. And this will track quickly. Now, what I want you to watch, by the way, is how dark this is, how clear it is. There's no other junk. There's no other objects. There's no other crud. There's no other debris. It's just a static picture with the gain of the camera bringing it up. All right, now you begin to see the scattering on the lens. All right, but there's no objects crisscrossing. There's no debris floating around. There's no crud from the payload bay. There's no, you know, urine dumps. This reversal, this black to white reversal, is a characteristic of these image intensifier cameras. If it's too bright at a certain gain setting, it flips to a negative and it goes dark. But in fact, that should be bright all the way up there. That's an artifact. Now, to after sunset, now you're about 45 minutes later into the night side, or half an hour later into the night side pass. All right? Actually, it's close to 45 minutes because that's the span of the night side orbit. Now you're coming up on another section. You're over South America now. All right? There we are. And now you can see the Earth. You still see the air glow dimly, but you can see the Earth, and you can see a bright thing up here just going out of frame, all right? And in a minute, what they're going to do from Houston is they're going to pan the camera so that you actually can look at that bright thing that we're passing. Why do we suddenly see the Earth and we didn't at sunset? Very simple reason. The moon rose. It's a quarter moon tonight. We've worked that out in the computer. So you're looking at moonlit clouds, all right? Now they're Now they're moving the camera, all right? They're looking back toward this collection of lights, which is about 1,000 miles away, kind of behind them, slantways. And they're leaving, but they're tilting the camera, this low light level camera, up out of the bay, looking up at the Earth. And they're looking back, and now he's going to zoom. The operator in Houston is going to zoom in. At some time in his timeline, he's told on a sheet to do this. At such and such GMT, you can read the GMT numbers off here, he is supposed to find this bright collection of lights, which is Santiago, Chile, located at 33.3 degrees south latitude, 33.3, and he's zooming in, and the reason it's dark and light is because it's going again to negative when the brightness is too bright for the camera gain and optics or the electronics to handle. Now he moves it around a little bit, all right? We know this is Santiago because we've matched the configuration of the outlying suburbs and villages and all that. No doubt where it is, all right? Now he moves up. Now watch carefully. Watch right in here, right in this section, all right? Don't blink. Do not, whatever you do, blink. Can we run that back again? This is what Art has been sitting on for a year. All right? There. Okay. There. Now, when you look at it frame by frame by frame, it looks like a tadpole. All right? And there's been a lot of effort on our part to deconvolve this, to analyze what it is. And my best bet now is, no, it's not a spaceship leaving from Santiago. It's something fired in tangentially from off frame right out here. And when it hits the atmosphere, tangent, all right? See, he's now looking. The camera operator didn't know what he was going to see. He was just told to look at this particular set of coordinates at this particular time. Now he's looking around. Yeah, fat chance, okay? He's not in on the game. He's not part of the C word. He is dumbfounded. Oh, my God. The Valley Girl effect again, all right? Now, the spacecraft is rapidly leaving Santiago. It's now about 1,500 miles away as it's down on the horizon. Now, as the camera operator finally decides this is crazy and zooms out, you will see what the odds of zooming in and framing and then having that thing appear in terms of the entire full disk night side area of the Earth. Look at how tiny that is. Now, Tom will say, doesn't count, because we didn't predict it. And I say, Tom is wrong, because somebody predicted it, and that's why he was zoomed in. The operator didn't know, but whoever wrote the flight plan did know. All right, and I will move along. Now we're up over the Amazon. We're approaching dawn, and we notice thunderstorms. Huge thunderbusters down below over the Amazon jungle. This is convective heating overturn, and you're getting very nice thunderstorm activity. Now notice the brightening, because the spacecraft is now sailing into dawn. You're exactly at the terminator, and the vertical stabilizer is kicking light back into the bay, and the AGC is now dimming the camera down, decreasing the sensitivity. So for a few moments here, you're going to see things get pretty bland, not much contrast. Watch over here, all right? Now remember, 45 minutes ago, this was absolutely clear. Nothing was going on in front of this camera. It was pristine, cold, hard vacuum. But watch as the spacecraft continues to sail further into dawn and the aspect ratio changes and the tail is then shadowed by the orbiter body and the scattered light goes away and the contrast comes back up. Watch right down in here, all right? Like there. Enter stage right. Our first subject. Enter stage left, our second subject. At which point, all hell breaks loose. Now, behind this, 200 and some miles below, there is lightning at dawn on the Amazon. Upstairs. Now, this object was moving along, and suddenly, it stops. Now, wait a minute. Whoa. Can you run that back just a bit? Newton's first law. An object in motion tends to remain in motion unless acted upon by an outside force.
An object at rest will tend to remain at rest unless acted upon by an outside force. We have an object, all right, which tracks along, and then just at the point where it goes from an optically resolved object to a point source that's too bright, it decides to station keep. It decides to hover in orbit with the shuttle. Thank you. Keep going. All right. Gilmore. That's all you can do? Oh, well. Okay. Now notice these other guys. Now notice this guy. The clouds, remember, are moving backward at 18,000 miles per hour, 5 miles per second. This thing is now, it started in this direction. Now it's moving in this direction with the clouds, and it's actually beginning to accelerate against the clouds. Whoa, did you see that one? This object is the most intriguing to me at the moment because it's now done a right angle turn. Oh my God. All right. It is now, now where the heck did he come from? Obviously that's a cop. Now look at these guys down here. Here's another one, all right? Now, this guy is still station-keeping with the clouds, but he's leaving us at 5 miles per second. Remember, he came in this way, stopped, hovered, then is moving back now. Now, watch what he's doing. He's accelerating. He's moving off the clouds, picking up speed. Oh, there's some other guys down here, all right? Notice this one is now station-keeping, all right? See how it's maintaining the same distance from the edge of the frame? But it's moving. In other words, it's out below the shuttle at some distance. Now this guy is now moved off the surface of the Earth. He's approaching the airglow layer. Now our guy in Houston says, oh my God, it says at this point I'm supposed to zoom in on these guys. So he's now moving it around and he's going to zoom in. And okay. And they're right there. In this screen, you can barely see them because it's there. There they are, right? Now watch them blink. Their blink rate changes. Blink, blink. What happened? Houston, I think we have a problem. I have had probably one of the world's preeminent experts in spacecraft selection mechanics, Marvin Zarnik, who was a veteran with Mercury, he's doing. It's obviously in the shadow of the orbiter, and right about here it pops out into sunlight. Poof. But it's still close enough to the camera to be resolved. It's only at this point that it gets far enough away that it goes from being a resolved object with an actual finite diameter to being an unresolved point, and then optically it does what other unresolved points like stars have done earlier in the video. And then it stops and hovers and begins to move at right angles backward away from the shuttle. Here's a set of breaks in the clouds, moonlit clouds, and you can see that it's now tracking optically with the viewing aspect from the shuttle, so that it's maintaining its station keeping relative to the damn spacecraft. And then it decides a little further, all right? Now the stuff behind it is several hundred miles below it, 200 miles below it. This thing is probably, a mile or two out. All right? Where's a cop when you need one? Well, now, it's still station-keeping. All right, look at all this other crud. Now, NASA claims this is... There he is. Late, as usual. Now, look what he does. He appears out of nowhere, out of hyperspace. He just appears. Because remember, the shadow is down here. And then he starts to station-keep, and you can gauge the distance to the edge of the frame. This, via Newton, is impossible. And as I was saying before we lost the lights, Marv Zarnik, who's a veteran of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and the shuttle, and actually taught Aldrin what he knows, in part, worked together with him for the lunar landing profile, he looked at this and had a kitten. Because Yes, we're calling him Meyer, for short. Because nothing in his experience, nothing in his celestial mechanics, nothing in any background has prepared him for the plane changes and maneuvers we're seeing. Now, meanwhile, back over here at the horizon, remember, watch that flash and watch. Did you see it? All right, back it up. Back the tape up, all right? What that is a weapons firing. All right, there. All right, stop. All right, now watch carefully. You see how this scattered light is brightening from the sunrise? There'll be a flash, and then right about here, there. See it? That is something moving at 1,000 miles per second. It's a weapon being fired from somewhere to the right of the shuttle, and it's the same delay and the same velocity of the weapons we see in STS-48. So there's a consistency. Now, is this Star Wars for real? Are we shooting at aliens? No. You know why? We missed. We missed by 40 miles. This is a show. This is a show for someone. Designed to impress someone. All right, now we're getting scattering. All right. Now we're about to lose. There's one little further event that occurs here. An object comes into frame down here, which is just a rotating object. It's a piece of debris, and it's spinning, and it glints and glints and glints on a very regular... Here, this is it, all right? I think that's it. Where is it? Do you see it? Because my angle is too steep. I'm not getting enough light. There it is. No, that's lightning. Now, there's a little object that comes in, and it just drifts, and it goes bing, 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 like that. It's just a rotator. It looks like the SLA panels when we went to the moon. They would disengage pieces of the Apollo spacecraft, and you'd see them tumbling out there in the far field. Anyway, it looks like this is over. Now this, by the way, is real dawn down on the deck. Oh, let me tell you where this took place. It took place at dawn, and at the high point of where it was going on, it was 19.5. degrees. Oh, and one other thing. It was orbit 195. It's over the Amazon. North? Well, it's 19.5 north. I'm sorry, 19.5 south. Yeah, I'm sorry. Now, stop. Pause. Still. Quick. Still. Can you get it so that it's... We lose the bar? I did it yesterday. There, thank you. Okay. This is the constellation of Orion. We actually have it on the web. You can go look. This is Orion. Orion at dawn, at the tangent. 19.5 to the horizon, actually, when all this took place. Except this bright thing should not be in Orion. It is not a star. It is not Betelgeuse. It's not Rigel. It is not the moon. I know because I checked with Redshift. It is a ship. It's station keeping on the other side of the shuttle. Okay, hit the button. And then the sequence goes. You can actually see the belt there as it brightens up. All right. Don't know. It depends on the size of the vehicles. If we assume that we're looking at the same size thing as was hanging over Mexico City, which is 30, 40 feet, something like that, I would say it's probably, you know, a mile out. But I think that's the object, the weapons object that fired the weapon. It's at the right angle, and the flash was primarily from that quadrant in terms of the camera. Because if I'm correct, there is a priesthood. There is a dedicated group whose job, self-defined, has been to lift humanity to another level. And they're doing it by a standard historical secret society initiative techniques, which means you don't tell almost anybody what you're doing, because you're them and you're not us. And our job is to decloak and to unveil and to uncode or decode these systems and processes and lay them out before everybody to decide whether that's how you want to spend your tax dollars and if you in fact agree with their objectives. We have no clue as to what their ultimate objectives are. I am extrapolating based on literature that is thousands of years old. Well, in thousands of years, things change. Institutions become decadent. People get rotten to the core. They become selfish. They become self-serving. They become greedy. They become very, very isolated and insulated from the people they are supposed to be serving, if they ever were supposed to be serving anyone. And the idea that this is all buried under the guise of a national mandated space effort, which sends ships to Mars and ships to the moon and ships to the outer planet. I mean, the flybys of Europa are according to this exact same geometry. The pictures that were supposed to come in from Europa, remember the last flyby on July 20th? Okay, lights. Kill the video and turn on lights, and I can have my lights back. There is a overwhelmingly obvious hidden agenda. We have been able, through the democratization of this technology, to find it. It is being used to serve someone without cluing in the rest of us. And after a very short break, we are going to segue to Tom Bearden, who is going to show you a stunning positive public use of this same technology, which is for the benefit of all mankind. Meet us back here in 10 minutes.